You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Welcome to the Best of Flashpoints for the week of February 1st, 2019. My name is Mike Biggs. Today on the program, we feature some highlights from our series of interviews from Tucson, Arizona. All this straight ahead coming up on the Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Today, we feature highlights from our series of interviews from Tucson, Arizona. Up first, we'll hear from civil rights activist Isabel Garcia talking about the growing deadly violence perpetuated by various U.S. security forces. Also, we'll hear from investigative journalist Todd Miller about the expanding U.S. militarization of the U.S.-Mexico border and much more. Listen to this.
Isabel, just for a moment, talk a little bit about you were a public defender for many years, but you have been defending the public for even longer. Just talk a little bit about your background and what you've been doing here in Tucson for the last forever.
Okay, well, thank you, Dennis, for that introduction. First, I'd like to say that I am the proud daughter of an immigrant from Mexico, 3 years of education, raised on the border in Naco, Sonora, and came to organize copper miners, which is what he did and all his family did. And he came to organize. We lived through seven strikes. So my father was a fighter for human rights. People don't imagine immigrants other than, even at the best of things is that they help our economy and all of that. Nobody talks about their efforts in the human rights fight. But anyway, and on my mother's side, we have six generations here. Imagine. So we've been at it for a long time. And so I was raised in that household, living through seven, strikes teaches you a lot, and went on to law school. And met up in 1976 with a group of young women, too. I was a first-year law student. The Manzo Area Council was advising immigrants simply on how to fill out their paperwork, and they were raided. So that was on the Friday night news, and I volunteered on Monday afternoon after law school. And there's four of us that have continued on since 1976. So what can I tell you? Within that, of course, I've been a mom and a single mom most of the time. And so I've been lucky that I was able to have a profession that paid. You have a right to a lawyer because of Gideon, right? You have a right to a lawyer if you're charged with a criminal offense. And with immigration, you're not entitled to a lawyer. If you have one, well, you're lucky, that kind of thing, because it's a civil in nature. But in addition to that, I believe my most important right, if you ask me, I mean, there's so many rights we have as human. But to me, is like to be free from the cops. Don't you dare ask me a question. Don't you touch me. And I was right, because that's where we're most imperiled. Using the immigrants, we have used the immigrants as the bad guys to imperil all of ourselves, because we've become totally militarized. Is it embarrassing that, labor unions were a concession to capital, and, they ran off elsewhere, and they ruined what my father helped create, a Chicano middle class here in Arizona, and they destroyed all of that. The copper miners were really corrupt, too. And so what do you think is creating the middle class now? Who do you think is availing themselves of the collective bargaining processes my father worked hard for? You guys know. Border Patrol. ICE. The police, the security, even the guards. I mean, we have become militarized because nobody paid attention, right? We have thousands and thousands of ICE agents. Why? Well, it wasn't Trump who sent them out. Democrats did. We have to acknowledge that. They fought us. Remember, we were the bad guys. Until the Dreamers came around, we were always the bad guys here at Derechos.
And here we are at Derechos, and we were just given a beautiful tour of this very important building. Talk a little bit about what happens here. We were just looking at a whole bunch of crosses that are being stored that have to do with the folks who were dying on the desert. So say something about Derechos, what this organization is about, and what those crosses mean to you.
Well, in 1993, we regrouped. We kept working since 1976. Some of us became lawyers, some were history professors. And so we knew we couldn't just give direct services. We had to change the narrative. We had to do heavy political work. And we knew that the civil rights framework was insufficient for the defense of migrants. And so we, in 1993, said we are for human rights. It's a human rights framework, and so we reorganized under Coalición de Derechos Humanos. And really, there's been so many struggles since then that it would take too long to talk about it, but I can say that what we do is to respond and accompany and fight along with the community. And in that regard, since the late 90s, people have been calling Derechos to say, you know, my brother crossed 5 weeks ago, and nobody's heard from him. So it was, you know, an organic thing that occurred here at Derechos Humanos that we began to receive calls from family members of people that we've disappeared. Now we all know. Now everybody knows the narrative. I mean, nobody paid attention to us back then. But in the mid-90s, we said, you know, this is bad. We cannot let this happen. Even though it was Clinton who I voted for and all of it, he did a triple whammy to us, right? NAFTA that resulted in the displacement of over 6 million subsistence farmers and their little economies. He did IRA-IRA, which limited the defenses to deportation that people had. And he began the real in earnest militarization of the border. Well, he didn't begin it. It was... Everything happens, you know. Reagan started talking about you can only be a sovereign nation if you control your borders militarily and all of that. So every single administration has financed that. And so our most important work has been to respond to that and look at what's happened. We have painted 3,000, almost 300 crosses right now. I forget the exact amount because the number of that is multiplied by the dozens and dozens of family members that are impacted by the loss of unnecessary loss.
What are those crosses? What are they?
We have a cross for every body or set of remains that have been found since 2000 along the Arizona-Sonora border alone.
So this is part of the other side of militarization and of closing down the border. That's where we are. 3,300 and those are the ones you found.
It's the only side of militarization. It's the only side of militarization. Death is the only side of militarization. The American public have been dealt a lie. People in Idaho and Pete King and all of these people lying about what exists at this border. I mean, it's an absolute lie. We have 3,000, almost 300 deaths, not because we have cartels, not because we have traffickers, not because we have bad violence along this border. Remember, San Diego, Nogales, El Paso, Naco, all continue, Laredo, continue to be the safest cities in the border. Somerton, Arizona, designated as the safest little city, right? So those deaths, we have a real crisis, and the deaths and violence have come from who? From us. Not cartels, not bad guys, not anybody. We have killed them. And those are only the people that have been found, because the more we build walls, the more we militarize, the more we build the wall, we disappear them. That's what we're doing now. And that's what we're doing is not only killing them, but disappearing them. So in effect, we have policies based on death called consequence delivery system that is based on death. You either die in the desert, we deport you, separate you from your family, social death. Some of those result in actual death. Then we have biological death. And we have ambiguous death because you have thousands and thousands of people who have no idea what happened to Juan. Whatever happened to him, we'll never know. I mean, I think we should be indicted in the International Criminal Court. Because these were all unnecessary deaths. We do not have a criminal justice issue here at this border or a national security issue at all. It's always been economics. I mean, we think we're so smart. We are a capitalist economy. What's the number one rule of capitalism? Supply and demand. I mean, come on. We've been wanting the cheap labor from Mexico forever. It's an economic, political, social phenomenon. That's what migration is. Now we see that the millions of people in migration, people are waking up, that this economic restructuring has caused major havoc in people's lives, right? And so as we talk about globalization and opening up, we are building borders and barriers for human beings. And that's been documented. I went to the United Nations, to Geneva, along with other people from across the world to talk about borders only. Borders. How deadly they've become. How deadly governments have made them or allowed them to be made. Here, we have made them deadly. And you know what the United Nations did after a lot of work by civil society and all is to issue, and I have the book in my car, recommended guidelines on the enforcement of human rights at borders. And it's amazing because here in this United Nations book, what struck me is that, you know, we've seen the photographs of men in the 50s saying, I am a man. Just recently, I am human. Black Lives Matter. I mean, you know, things that are obvious, right? Well, you open this book and it says something obvious like that. It says, international borders are not zones of exemption for the enforcement and respect of human rights. How about that? I mean, you know, it's just common sense stuff. Now we have to say it.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, Dennis Bernstein here. We're in Tucson, Arizona. We're speaking with Isabel Garcia, who is a longtime attorney, a human rights activist, civil rights lawyer, public defender, and many other things. We're here in a very special place. I'm here with the Flashpoints team, along with Miguel Gavilan Molina.
And Isabel, again, thank you for joining us. And my question, again, is the military buildup of the border. And it seems like, you know, outside of Tijuana to, you know, Calexico, it's already been militarized. And we can thank the Democratic Party and Bill Clinton, the Democrat president, for creating that and initiating Operation Gatekeeper, which forced people to come to Arizona and through a place that I called El Pasaje del Diablo by Sonarita. And there, you know, the body count began. I believe that since 1994, it's been estimated anywhere from 8 to 12,000 plus people have been lost from here, Arizona, all the way to Brownsville. Mm-hmm. But the majority is here in Arizona. So the impact of that is happening here. The worst part of the desert is here in Arizona. That militarization, there's a lot of corporations in Southern California near that whole Coachella Valley, massive military there. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that personnel works in Arizona, works in conjunction. That military buildup and the fact that a couple of months ago, 4 months ago or so, the president sent, you know, 6,000-7,000 troops to the border. Those thousands of troops are still here, mostly in Arizona, which brings up the whole question of when you have a militarized border, the other side, the other country, the other government sees it as a potential, you know, military aggression. Why are you building up soldiers on your border? If not for the intent, obviously not for offensive purposes, but defensive purposes. Or what do military, what does the army do? It occupies. The Tohono Nation is already under military occupation. But that rest of the borderline, And on the other side, you know, there's a grave concern. This is almost an act of war. How has that impacted Tucson and the indigena Mexican community in this area?
Well, you've got to understand that we've been dealing with this longer than anybody else. In 2003, for instance, we as Derechos, we organized a coalition, of human rights activists, environmental activists, and indigenous activists. 2003, we held major, hearings and conferences and all of that because we have felt the impact. Remember, we have open areas because we have beautiful environmental treasures. San Pedro River, Oregon Pipe National Monument, Buenos Aires Wildlife, all of these areas that my father took us to see, beautiful places, we're militarizing them. You've got border patrol everywhere. If you talk to the people in Arivaca, 26 miles in or whatever, kilometers in, they'll tell you about the occupation that they've got to go through checkpoints all the time. I'll take you to Texas, where now many deaths are happening in Texas now, many more. I don't know if there's more here or there because many, many deaths are happening in Texas. You know, we work with Eddie Canales, who helps to recuperate bodies and such in private property. So, you know, I mean, it's really a horrendous thing that's going on. So the militarization has been part of the Border Patrol. We've been saying for years, you're militarizing the... Oh, no, we're just a civil... And until Ferguson happened, when a Republican congressman said on TV, oh, my God, we're militarizing civil police. It's like, we've been telling you. What do you think the Border Patrol is? It's a civil law enforcement agency. And by militarizing them, we have normalized. We use immigrants to normalize. We use immigrants to normalize. Even the occupation with the military, you tell, oh, yeah, look at the hordes, the caravans are coming, and everybody in Iowa says, oh, yeah, we need to, you know, build that up. And then they act as if the border is just an empty parking lot. How dare they, right? But because they've got we've got these beautiful areas, they are utilizing the really unbelievable, illegal, the Real ID Act to be able to waive, 26 federal laws.
What is that?
The Real ID Act was signed in December of 2005, and it dealt with standardization of driver's license. You guys have all dealt with that if you go through that. But within that, it says that the Department of Homeland Security Secretary can, with a signature, they call it waive. When we do anything, it's violate, you're criminal, illegal. Look at that. They can violate all of those laws. Not only all our federal laws, but state and local ordinances as well. Everything is waived because the Department of Homeland Security signs by a waiver. Imagine that. And so we've been feeling the militarization, but I'll tell you, it has felt a difference when we were in Nogales. Nogales is very depressed, the people, the community, because this is Ambos Nogales. This is a community that has always been one. And the pain that they feel of, I was there during the School of the Americas Watch conference, the pain seeing the concertina wire going up with military guys pointing guns because they're to defend the guys putting up the wiring. And it's unbelievable. With Mexico, who's over half land you took, whose riches you have exploited all these generations, whose best and brightest had come out of Mexico to build this country? How dare you, right? So, I mean, here we are. And people don't understand that we have the Posse Comitatus. And if you don't understand that, you need to know that, you know, we can't use the military to enforce our civil law. And Trump is coming pretty close to doing that. Well, we've made many inroads, horrible inroads to that protection, with people not even realizing and say, yeah, send the troops there, right? Used to be where the troops defense used to be with us and say, do not send us there because, we're trained to kill. That's when we were still at war with the Soviet Union and all that stuff, right? And when that crumbled, all of a sudden they turned and said, oh yeah, I guess we can.
Again, listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio here in Tucson, Dennis Bernstein with Miguel Gavilan Molina and the Flashpoints team. We're speaking with Isabel Garcia, who is a longtime human rights activist. Isabel, most people in the rest of the country don't really understand what's going on. They don't understand the devastation. When you talk about the devastation of Nogales, we were talking earlier. I was here in the 80s, you know, when you could have the wedding on one side of the border and the reception on the other side of the border, where it was clear it was one community. People talked about parades happened, you know, and marches happened on both, wove back and forth across the border. That's all lost, isn't it, based on this militarization?
Yes, it is. I'm writing the year 1971. 1971 is the year I graduated from high school here at Pueblo High School. But 1971 is the level of migration that we have yet to reach. We have yet to reach the migration level we saw in 1971. Do people understand that? That we don't have a crisis at the border? You can go to any border town. The crisis is of humanitarian concern, of people from Honduras and Central America fleeing because of the unbearable conditions that we have had a large hand to, you know, to have to do with. So, you know, that's one thing that people need to know. We are, you know, there's a beauty in social media and all of that, but it also comes to sting us. All they focus on is, you know, the visuals of thousands of people in a caravan. And remember, these caravans violate our... Remember I told you migration is an economic phenomenon? Well, you know, this stops. Well, not only because globalization has changed so that we don't need as much labor, we can just export it and mechanize everything else, but we've always wanted labor to come in at 15, 16, 17, 18 and above, male and everybody able to work. We don't want children. We don't want children. We don't want to raise them. We don't want children on top of the racism.
All right. We thank you so much for taking the time out, and we hope we can continue our multi-year dialogue in this struggle for human rights here. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming here. That's the most important thing to do, for you to tell the truth and the reality of this situation.
We're delighted to be joined by Todd Miller. He has been reporting extensively about the impact of the militarization of the border. His latest book is Storming the Wall, Climate Change, Migration, and Homeland Security. And we are grateful that you have invited us into your house. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
I want people to know a little bit about your background. You have been deeply engaged in reporting about the border, impacts of free trade and the militarization of the border. Could you just give us a general background of what your beat's been and what you've been up to?
I've been reporting on border issues probably since the late 1990s, early 2000s, and that's about the same time where in southern Arizona, where we are right now, we started hearing stories about bodies being found in the desert, bodies of people, border crossers, or people crossing into the United States. And it was really at that point that I started reporting in very small venues at that, in that era about, you know, really trying to look in depthly into what were the reasons behind why people were coming, what were the border policies that were forcing people into the desert and desolate areas and that sort of thing. And I did that for many years. And I also, during that time, lived in Oaxaca, Mexico for about 4 years, from about 2005 to 2009. Also, while in Oaxaca, I was looking at root causes of immigration, so to speak, like what were the economic policies coming from the United States that were at least influencing how, you know, how people lived in communities in southern Mexico, and communities, many of them, where lots of people had left and gone north. And so migration was becoming more and more a factor, and trying to look at, you know, some of those economic models that seem to benefit large corporations, but were not so beneficial to, you know, regular people. My first book was Border Patrol Nation, and then my second book was also looking at climate change and the displacement and how the U.S. government is looking into the future, 15, 25, 50, 100 years into the future, and seeing climate displacement as something to respond to with further border militarization.
I want to pick you up right there. Talk about the expanding militarization of the border. I mean, this, I guess, started with Clinton really started to build up. Talk about that.
Sure. Yeah. Clinton. Well, one of the really interesting things to look at when we look at the current border apparatus is a congressional hearing in 1992 when Doris Meisner, who was the commissioner of INS, stood before Congress and said, we need to harden our borders. We need to further harden our borders because the North American Free Trade Agreement, which is, of course, was already passed, but it was going to be implemented in 1994, was going to cause migration from Mexico into the United States. And so basically Meisner said that to Congress, and then the Clinton administration said, okay, we're going to do it. And so a number of operations happened during the Clinton administration, particularly in the mid-1990s, Operation Hold the Line, Operation Gatekeeper, Operation Safeguard. And these operations centered around different border cities, which were traditional safe places for people to cross, under a strategy known as prevention through deterrence. So what the idea was that with bigger budgets, and if you look in the 1990s, the budget started to double. And then at one point towards the end of the Clinton administration, even almost triple. That's how it was a historic growth of the U.S. border apparatus. And with those budgets came walls. So the wall that we're talking about right now, well, you go back to the 1990s and you see these big walls being constructed in Nogales and San Diego and Brownsville and in El Paso. And then more agents were hired. So by 2000 or by 2001, there's 10,000 Border Patrol agents. And the whole idea of the strategy was they were going to seal off these safer places to cross, and that people would have to funnel around those places and go into places that were desolate, dangerous, dangerous, like the Arizona desert, which would be too dangerous to cross. And so you have that kind of blueprint fundamental of preventive deterrence from the 1990s, which is a strategy still in place today. Which if you look at all the media reports about the border, like, you know, let's just look at the last month. I don't think one of, you know, only very few are going to mention the actual border strategy that's been in place for over 20 years. But that's where the border we have, the beginnings of the kind of militarized border we have. From there, the post 9/11 era, 2001 happens, and all of a sudden, the Department of Homeland Security is formed, and the border and Customs and Border Protection and Immigration and Customs Enforcement are formed, are created under the Department of Homeland Security, and the budgets come in, the budgets start to flow even more. And so what happened was that basically the Border Patrol and ICE, they get their priority mission becomes stopping terrorists and weapons of mass destruction from crossing the border, of which there's not one documented case of, but why does that matter? Because the budget started to flow even more. So if you look from 1994, the annual budget for border enforcement was $1.5 billion. In 2018, last year, it was $23 billion. And when Trump took office, it was $20 billion. So we're looking at massive historic growth of the border budgets over the last 25 years.
And talk a little bit about the impact in terms of the quality of life. We've talked earlier. I was down here reporting for Newsday in the late 1980s. And at that time, you could go to a wedding on the Mexican side of Nogales and then go to the reception, just hop over a fence or just come through a little trail, and the reception would be in Nogales, Arizona. Talk about the quality of life and the kinds of impact this militarization has had.
I'm glad you brought up that example. That example is so good. And you hear, like, you go down to Nogales, you hear all kinds of examples that are very similar. The September 16th Independence Day Parade used to weave on either side of the border, back and forth, back and forth. If there's a fire on the Mexican side or fire on the U.S. side, fire trucks from either side would go to the other side to help fight the fire. The kind of cross-border community ties are very strong. You know, there's brothers and sisters, mothers and, parents and children, cousins, friends. One friend of mine, he used to talk about going through the hole in the chain link fence. There was a chain link fence, but it was filled with holes. And he said, we used to complain about the little chamaco, which is like the little kid that would charge us a peso for crossing through this hole, you know. And that's not to say that there weren't problems. Like, the Border Patrol was formed in 1924, so they were around. They just were not as significant. They didn't have a wall. And then 1994, if you take the example of Nogales, March of 1994, all of a sudden the chain link fence is extracted. The landing mats, they used landing mats from the Vietnam War and the Persian Gulf Wars, were brought in, and they constructed an almost 20-foot-high wall with those landing mats. So talk about militarization of the border, literal. Yeah, right there for at least 10 miles. I think – I can't remember the exact length of it, but it was – at least 5 to 10 miles of a wall, 20 feet. It's, 20 feet is pretty high, right through Nogales. So the chain link fence is gone. It cuts right through, where there's all those ties. The people in Nogales say, on either side of the border, they call it Ambos Nogales, because the idea is that it's not two communities, it's one community. Right. And so this wall just cuts right through that one community. And you can see that everywhere that, the kind of the boundary, the U.S.-Mexico boundary goes along the length of the 2,000 miles, it's always cutting through communities that are intimately tied. From, like, if you go a little bit further to the west, you have the Tonawatam Nation, which, if you look at the Tonawatam Nation, it's the second largest Native American reservation in terms of size in the United States, the size of the state of Connecticut. But it's just a fraction of the Aboriginal land of the Tonawatam, who extended deep into Mexico and deep, all the way to practically to Phoenix and pretty much a good chunk of southern Arizona. And so when the surveyors came and after in 1853, and they after the Gadsden Purchase or in the Mexican-American War, And they just started building this boundary line right through the Tonantum Nation. It's like somebody going into a town in Kansas and going to some random town and going, okay, boom, we're gonna create this boundary right through the middle of your town. And then next thing you know, you have agents guarding this boundary, and you have people, you know, from the Tonantum, and again on either side of the border, who, you know, not it's the family and community ties and the cultural ties. And, you know, people on the Mexican side go to Cells, which is the town on the Tonantum Nation, to go to the hospital and to go to school. And now they have to deal with this border apparatus.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Todd Miller here in Tucson, Arizona. This is an expanded report by the Flashpoints team to document what's been going on at the border, the militarization of the border. Could you talk a little bit about some of the abject brutalities that aren't all that well publicized in the rest of the country?
Yeah, there's plenty of them. One that immediately comes to mind is in October of 2012, when a Border Patrol agent shot 16 times into Mexico. They say they wanted to see through it, but you also can put a gun through it and shoot through it. And that's exactly what happened. A young man named Jose Antonio Leonel Rodriguez was walking to meet his brother where he was working at his store, and he was shot almost, I think, 10 times in the back. The Border Patrol claims that he was throwing rocks. And if you look at where it happened, it's like a 20-foot, like Nogales is a city of many canyons, and there's a canyon that's at least 20 feet or 25 feet, and then there's a 20-foot wall, right? So if you stand under there, you have to look like at least 40 feet and imagine trying to shoot a rock, or that would be harmful to somebody on the other side of the wall. But that was the claim that justified, according to the Border Patrol agent, him shooting into Mexico. And so that's one example of many, unfortunately, of people being killed, what Border Patrol calls excessive use of force, which has, I don't have the exact stats on me right now, but it has risen, especially in the last 10 years. And it's risen, of course, with the expansion of the Border Patrol. And the expansion's been very significant. Again, if you go from 1994, where there's 4,000 agents, to now, there's between 21 and 22,000. So there's a fivefold increase. There are more agents with more weapons, with more assault rifles, with more bullets, with more power, with more expansion, and of course there's more incidents. And those are the incidents that's one of the ones, and the ones that have been documented that we know about. But you have to imagine that the Border Patrol, for example, is patrolling in often not in the cities, in places that are not necessarily in the public eye, like the deserts, places where they can possibly do anything and nothing would happen, right? Or at least they could obscure what happened from the public space.
More people die in the deserts now, right? And the Border Patrol actively participates in the risk that they've created by building the walls where there weren't any walls. So people are forced to cross at places where they are much more at risk. And the Border Patrol sort of, not only does it seem to care, but it arrests people who are trying to reach out to folks who are pushed to try and cross the desert in places where they're probably going to lose their life.
That is purposely the strategy since 1994, the prevention through deterrence. If you look at the first strategy memorandum by the Border Patrol, it says it actually uses the word mortal, like the idea that people forced into the desert, that it could be mortal, and then quote unquote mortal, and then that would be a deterrence, right? Of course, more people at that point came, and than ever before, really, for a good 10 years. And what happened when people would funnel around where the militarization, where the walls and agents were, and go into the deserts. And that's why now we have approximately 8,000 remains of people that have been found since that time. And that's an undercount. That's definitely an undercount, because those are like the the actual sets of remains that were found. And there's thousands of families that are looking for their missing loved ones. And they you know, you have to imagine that there's probably over 10,000, if not even more, people who have died crossing through the borderlands and the desert borderlands or anywhere. I mean, we're talking from San Diego to Brownsville.
You're listening to Flashpoints. Dennis Bernstein here in Tucson, Arizona, with my colleague Miguel Gavilan Molina, and we're speaking with Todd Miller.
Thank you, Todd, for bringing that up. And it's something that's a grave concern. Those numbers, 8 to 10, can be even go as high as 15,000, scattered throughout the borderlands. But if we look at that, and you mentioned the date 1994, that's a real important time. The Democrats were in control, and Clinton was under tremendous scrutiny for his misbehaving. But that created the opportunity by the government, the Democratic government at that point, to start Operation Gatekeeper. And what Operation Gatekeeper did was militarize the California to Arizona border and forcing people into Arizona. And they knew exactly what to do. In Arizona, by the town of Sonarita, you have El Pasaje del Diablo. It's called El Pasaje del Diablo, which means the Devil's Passage. And that passage is one of the most desolate, remote. Nothing lives there. No plants, not even the Gila monster. Why? Because it's like 115, 120 during, the summer months. And people just literally evaporate. And that's where you started finding bodies. Well, since then, those numbers have increased into the thousands. With that, from Arizona all the way to Brownsville, recently during the Honduras, Guatemalan human rights crisis and the exodus happening, the government ordered 5,000, 6,000 military, personnel. This is Army. This isn't the INS. This isn't ICE. These are not Border Patrol. This is the U.S. Army to go to the border. Well, since there wasn't a need for engagement, soldiers are there to defend and kill. They're not there to help, to offer humanitarian aid, to offer water, nothing. They're there to shoot and kill. And since the crisis kind of, backfired on the administration, those troops are still in the area. I know from talking to the Tohono officials and some of the members from the nation, they've said that there's about 500 to 700 U.S. soldiers right now on their land. Yeah. So it is a military occupation of sovereign lands. And my fear is once you bring in the military and, the White House threats that Mexico's going to pay, Mexico's going to do this, once you bring in soldiers to the border, what's the next step? Invasion or some kind of crisis or creating the thing, and then you have an international military crisis. And that's what seems to be happening here. What is your take on that?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, the Army active duty troops, I just saw them myself like 2 days ago in Nogales. The National Guard was deployed in the border in the April as well. Of course, the Obama administration deployed the National Guard as well, and so did the Bush administration. The Bush administration had one of the biggest deployments of the National Guard around 2006 was 6,000, when they're hiring 6,000 Border Patrol agents. In my view, too, the Border Patrol itself, they act like soldiers. I mean, they act like military themselves. It's like when you drive around the borderlands and you have to constantly stop at the checkpoints and, you have armed agents who are like looking in your car and doing their visual inspections and profiling. The Department of Homeland Security is the one department that's quote-unquote allowed to racially profile people, and that would give them reasonable suspicion, to then interrogate somebody further. And so you're constantly going through this kind of racialized, militarized zone where you have like these agents, and then they're armed themselves and they have all this power. And then they're back. Then on top of that, they have this extra military presence that we've been seeing on the border lately. And as many people on the Tohono O'odham Nation say, I mean, people call it on the Tohono O'odham Nation, just about everyone I know on the Tanatam Nation calls it an occupation. So you're talking about an occupation like in Palestine, you know, like an occupation, a military occupation where of a system of control, you know, in the Tanatam Nation, you cannot leave on a paved road without going through a border patrol checkpoint. There's no way you could go to the east, go to the north, go to the west. You have to go through a border patrol checkpoint. And it's so much that, you know, some people on the nation have a new term they call checkpoint trauma. You know, checkpoint trauma, like even little kids will be playing in their car, but they know they'll be approaching the checkpoint, and then all of a sudden they'll get quiet. And almost, you know, there was one ACLU who's done like a border kind of, they've had a border program in southern Arizona for quite a while, or for at least like 7 years now. But they had a meeting in cells in the Tanatam Nation, and they asked, who here has had a negative experience with the Border Patrol? And, you know, there was 100 people, and they said every single person raised their hand. Every single person has had some sort of incident with the Border Patrol in this kind of roughshod militarized zone, right, where whether it be, you know, you're getting tailed with their brights on and they're spotlighting you from the back to being pulled out of your car and hit with a billy club or maced, or there's been incidents where people have been shot. There's one incident where a young man was run over and killed by the Border Patrol. And
we're out of time, but I have to tell you, Todd Miller, that the information you share is incredibly important. I want to remind people again that your latest book is Storming the Wall, Climate Change, Migration, and Homeland Security. And again, thanks for taking the time out to be with us on this special edition of Flashpoints.
Oh, it was great to be on.
Sevgiyim donori ganyay baba nonovan kısa pinta anyay hudunin donori tam otam sapinta siarim anyay siarim sevacıta anyay çevut gacim sevgiyim donori ganyay baba nonovan Sevgiyim donori ganyay baba nonovan kısa pinta anyay hudunin donorik tam otam
My name is Sebastian Kinak. Kinak in Kakchikel, my first language, means beans. I'm from Guatemala, from the area Kakchikel. I came to the U.S. about 35 years ago, in 1981-82, when a lot of violence that went on in Guatemala, well, it's still on, but I want to touch that a little bit. I work with the Guatemalan, it's like an organization. It's based on my area, the Chimaltenango. And I worked organizing peasants, leaders, campesinos, leaders de campesinos, and also indigenous people, youth, women around their rights. And that was the 80s. And then when the government accused us being like gorillas subversives, yes. And then the group of people where I work with, a lot of them were kidnapped and killed, tortured. So in the 82, I got about two death threatened letters and asking for 50,000 quetzales to give to those who are kidnapping people. So they said, it's your decision if you want to be alive. So give us those 50,000 quetzales. And in that time, 50,000 is a lot. Because I remember I worked for a day, like making 25 cents or 30 cents a day. I decided to contact people who live in the mountain fighting for the rights, you know. And then at that time, also one of my co-worker left Guatemala years before I did. And she contacted me and she said, if you want to come here, we'll find someone to bring you to the U.S. So I asked, well, I would like to go there, but I don't know how to do, what to do. And she said, don't worry about that. We work on that. So the thing is, when we started working for the indigenous rights, as we've been hearing here right now, it's the land is number one for us, the indigenous people. If you have no land, no life. That was the struggle since then, since the 75, 80, up to this time. So that was why I left. Now, I came to the U.S. with that paper. Someone brought me to Mexico, and then I crossed the border like anyone else doing right now. So I crossed the border, and I went to California, San Francisco, California directly. And some people who helping refugees in that time, they asked me if I want to apply for political asylum. So I didn't understand anything about political asylum. So I answered them that I'm not politicians. Why should I ask for political asylum? And then someone helped me to understand what it means to apply for political asylum. A couple months, I think, I decided to apply for political asylum. I got my the lawyer who helped me at the Bay Area. He applied for my work permit at that time. So I got my work permit. I had for 4 years, but they never called me for an interview, the immigration, for a political asylum. So after like 4 or 5 years, they did not renew my permit. So I stayed in the Bay Area without document until I met my wife. And now is my wife in Oakland, California. So I start working with migrants. Even I have no paper. I work with migrants with or without document. I work around or close to some lawyers who help migrants too. And that's the way I start and be involved with migrants, indigenous, and human rights activity in the U.S. So in Guatemala, I was 15 years old when I started working with people. So I thought, like, what was my passion to help people wherever I am. So that was in the U.S.
Well, thank you for that description. I'm going to fast forward you now. It is important to remember that you left your country when the United States was supporting people like Rios Montt and Hector Gramajo. Hector Gramajo said everybody should have a Bible and a machine gun. And Gramajo was the head of the military that led slaughters in the highlands, in your homelands, that cost tens of thousands of people their lives, their homes, their families. So it was a situation that even led the United States, certainly wasn't enough to apologize for their participation in a genocide in your country. In other words, the United States has recognized that they participated in a genocide in your country. I want to get your gut reaction when you see the U.S. government opening fire on people who are fleeing from Guatemala and Honduras, and then you've got U.S. politicians yelling it and saying, how could these parents from these countries jeopardize their kids' lives? You know, don't they really care about their kids? Your thoughts on all of this?
When I left Guatemala and then I start working here now, I am helping my people, Guatemalan. Almost all of them are indigenous people. Yeah, the idea here is that when a kid crosses the border or comes by themselves or a family or an adult, some people think they don't want to work or they just want to think about American dream. I always, when I talk in the community with a college or whoever, I tell them, I am not here because American dream, and I don't think my people or a lot of my people are coming because American dream. It is because what's going on in Guatemala. It's the rich people, companies, corporations are still taking indigenous people land. They displace them. And then when indigenous people are the Mayan people, no place to live, what else they can do? And they have to leave their country looking for a place to save their life like I did. So I think any person in the U.S., especially politicians, right-wing politicians, think that migrants, refugees are coming here to commit murder or to do whatever against the law is not true. It's completely against our dignity, our rights, against what we believe in and what we are and who we are. So people don't believe that violence, torture, kidnap still going on in Guatemala. Last year, human rights organization reported about like 18 or 17 indigenous leaders were killed because they were protecting their land so that the mine companies will not take from them.
Extract,
yes. And that's why they still leave in their country. So it's... when I talk, always go back my experience. On the streets in the 80s, I saw bodies laying down on the street, burning on gasoline done by the army. And about 10 years ago, here in the desert, at the Ona Nation land, a group of volunteers invited me to go to look for Guatemalan people. I found a Mayan woman from El Quiche lying down like exactly what I saw in Guatemala in the 80s. That makes me, I cried a lot and thinking about, I am not in Guatemala in the 80s. I am in the U.S. and looking at the body, a Mayan Kachikel woman, sorry, Quiche woman lying in there, just looked black and her hair all around her because the animals are taken from her. So going back to your question, what I'm thinking about kids, adults, families leaving their country, it's not because they want to, because they are forced to do. Otherwise, they die there. Now, when I talk with my people, I do a lot of volunteers with the Catholic Community Services and with other communities, Samaritanos, No More Death, Humane Border, other organization here. So I talk with the people who leave Guatemala. So they said directly, when I cross here, I am willing to die here instead of taking me to a place, torture me, or kill me like alive to torture. So in other words, people are willing to do whatever or to suffer whatever from Guatemala to the border of Mexican U.S. because there is no way to live in Guatemala economically, politically, culturally. So all those who are in trouble. I mean, like a big problem for the community, indigenous people community.
Does it for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Kevin Pina and Miguel Gavilan Molina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, part two of the beauty industry expose, The Illusionists. So, drop those eyebrow tweezers and please stay tuned. Today, our second and final installment of the film The Illusionists, written, directed, and produced by Elena Rossini. It's about the damage done by the hugely profitable so-called beauty industry. This documentary is international in scope, and it focuses on men as well as on women. All good. In part one last week, we looked at how the industry deliberately makes people insecure, and how it promotes an extremely narrow image of female beauty worldwide. Always pale skin, long legs, and skinny. This week, the film looks more at skinniness, and also at computer-retouched images of female beauty, at the image of male beauty they're selling, at the sexualization of children, at the connections between the beauty industry and the porn industry, and at how to fight back. So put down that bottle of Slim Fast, take off those high heels, chuck that Brazilian bikini wax into the trash can, and enjoy part two of The Illusionists.
The weight loss industry could be defined as the capitalist success story of the 20th century, as no other business with a 98% failure rate could earn as much, $586 billion a year worldwide. Similarly to the anti-aging business, the weight loss industry would have modest earnings if people succeeded in losing weight and keeping it off. Most people who diet do so in cycles, dieting over and over again in the hope of achieving a slimmer figure. And contradictory messages allow for nearly infinite growth and expansion.
A collage of TV ads shows sensuous images of high-calorie food products. Women are eating this junk food with expressions of rapture and bliss, and also images of weight loss products and girdles. Excuse me, shapewear.
It's a little-known fact that the multinational Unilever, the same company that owns Dove and Fair and Lovely Skin Whitening Cream, had a curious acquisition spree in April 2000. Unilever purchased the ice cream brand Ben & Jerry's and the weight loss drink Slim Fast on the same day. Prudential Securities analyst John McMillan commented in the Wall Street Journal, "The fact that one product makes you fat and one makes you thin is funny, but they didn't say boo to address that." In some ways, corporations don't care if you're skinny or overweight. They make money as long as the bar of what is considered attractive is very difficult to reach. Over the years, the size of fashion models has dramatically decreased. Despite this, today even waify models aren't thin enough for advertisers. Digitally retouching models in order to make them appear thinner is standard practice.
Gene Kilbourne.
Recently, Ralph Lauren ran an ad in which the model had been photoshopped to have an impossible body. Her head was actually bigger than her pelvis. The actual model, who was 5'10 and weighed 115 pounds, was fired for being too fat, and they used Photoshop to make this grotesque image. And I'm sure we're going to see more and more of that. The human body just cannot get any thinner. The models can't get any thinner than they are, but they can use Photoshop to make a thinner and thinner image.
And when models are too skinny, protruding bones are routinely airbrushed out. Because these images of unattainable bodies are everywhere, they reach not only those who are overweight, but also people who don't need to diet, with dangerous consequences. For centuries, Japan and neighboring Asian countries valued diverse body types. A curvy female body symbolized wealth and fertility. But things changed starting in the 1980s. A dramatic increase in eating disorders swept across the region. According to a study conducted by Dr. Tetsuya Ando at the National Institute of Mental Health, about 30% of Japanese women in their 20s are categorized as underweight. Whereas obesity is increasing amongst men, women's average body mass index is decreasing year after year.
Many young women think their bodies are oversized, even if they are underweight. That's surprising.
Researcher Jason Carlin.
I think one of the things that you see in the Japanese media, which is also present, in fact, in other places as well, is that there's a kind of a gap between what men and women perceive as ideals of beauty. For example, those that do appeal to a male audience, those that are often the idols that you hear about in Japanese media culture, tend to have a kind of aesthetic to them that is not like the aesthetic that you would associate with Western models. They tend to be shorter in stature. They tend to have characteristics of femininity that are almost, in some sense, the opposite of what we would associate with the long-legged models in the West. And in part, the explanation for this has always been that traditionally the male audience within Japan of young adolescent men are attracted to images of women who are more accessible, more attainable. On the other hand, Japanese women go to the opposite extreme of trying to cultivate that body image that they see in women's magazines, which are women's bodies that are very thin, with very long legs, and with many of the characteristics that we associate with this kind of global culture of beauty that is circulating throughout the world.
Mumbai, India.
I grew up watching movies in the 70s and the 80s where actresses like Rekha or Rakhi or Hema Malini, you know, the nice hourglass figures, you know, padded, sort of more what I call traditional looking, embodying a certain image that was close to home, what home was then, pre-globalization. Now what we're seeing is, well, a trend towards an imitation of the westernized body image. These girls literally are fighting for the size zero, which was never known as beautiful in India.
Part 3, Brave New World.
Around the world, the market for men's grooming products has seen an explosive growth in the last few years. There's a new war being waged against men's body hair.
Manscaping. It's the act of tweezing, waxing, dissolving, and shaving unwanted hair from all parts of your body. In fact, these days, many men are choosing to do away with practically every bit of hair as part of their regular men's grooming routine. Yes, that includes the nether regions.
Taking care of the hair down there certainly has its benefits. You might say when there's no underbrush, the tree looks taller.
Start at the hairline and shave to the base using single strokes. Shave in the direction of the hair initially to remove as much as you can.
I wouldn't date a guy who had grooming problems, so no.
The trend for hairlessness may have started in pornography, an industry that is exponentially larger and more profitable than the mainstream film business.
The Triple X Factor. Boston. Professor Gail Dines.
So, let's talk about the size of this industry. Now, really accurate statistics are hard to come by. Generally speaking, they say that pornography is about a $12 billion a year industry, which is bigger than the mainstream film industry in America. Worldwide, they reckon it's $97 billion.
A clip from Perversion for Profit, 1965.
Hello there. I'm George Putnam. I'd like to begin with a fact. A simple yet shocking fact. It is this. A flood tide of filth is engulfing our country in the form of newsstand obscenity and is threatening to pervert an entire generation of our American children. A major factor that makes youngsters prime targets for this printed filth is the natural curiosity of youth about the mysterious force of sex.
You live in a society absolutely awash with porn images, softcore porn images, from Victoria's Secrets to Maxim to music videos. Let me ask you a question. Would you all agree that the food industry shapes the way you eat? Would you agree that the clothes industry shapes the way you dress? So would you not say the sex industry shapes the way we have sex? How could this be the only industry that has no effect in the world? You cannot make sense of media images of women today without starting your analysis at pornography. Everywhere you look, MTV, movies, video games, everywhere you go, you see images that really 15 years ago you would have found in mainstream pornography. And this is the process that has happened. The mainstreaming of pornography now in pop culture.
A collage of erotic and very suggestive images from popular culture, especially advertising.
Pornography has a very specific idealized image of women. Thin, toned, big-breasted, and above all, hairless. And when you think of young boys and young men getting their first introduction to sex via pornography, they become kind of accustomed to seeing women with absolutely no body hair. And what I have found in my interviews, very interestingly, is that a lot of boys and men are really disgusted by women's pubic hair because they're just not used to it. And in some cases, I've even heard from my students that their boyfriends refuse to have sex with them if they've got body hair. And this could have very severe consequences when you are bringing up a generation of men who really are disgusted by what looks like an adult woman.
Get ready to weigh in, get ready to take sides, because some parents are going to argue to you that it's just fine for little girls to get luxurious spa treatments, and we're not just talking manicures here, we're talking about bikini waxes.
Well, because I've been brought up in a porn culture, I feel like body image is focused on a lot, and growing up I always had that trouble, like I have to match up to these expectations. But why? They're not my expectations, but they're what society made us think that is okay.
The mainstreaming of pornography into popular culture has had profound consequences in the ways young girls are portrayed in the media.
A televised beauty pageant for toddlers. A girl contestant, maybe 3 years old, breaks out into an erotic bump and grind.
Now, this is something you are seeing across the media. You are seeing younger and younger girls made to look like women. And this can have incredible implications and consequences for young girls.
Oh, I know what this look needs. My little rhinestone-studded butterfly barrette. It's right here in my closet.
Whoa, that's not a closet. That's a planet called fashion.
Getting them young. Activist Susan Lin.
There's a kind of marketing that's called aspirational marketing.
And that's another example of how children's just normal developmental evolution is exploited. It's perfectly normal for little kids to want to be like older kids.
I made $50,000 in the stock market today.
I had twins.
I went to the poor farm.
I'm on Millionaire Acres. That's life.
The game of life.
And the marketing industry got the bright idea of saying, well, if preschool girls want to be like teenagers, let's market to them as if they were teenagers. And it began with Barbie.
Barbie, you're beautiful. You make me feel. My Barbie doll is really real.
Whose fashionista are you?
Are you a girly girl?
Collect all six.
Virtually every classic toy has followed the trend, undergoing a radical transformation.
Welcome to the world of strawberry shortcake.
Strawberry shortcake, putting on the glitz, featuring glittering nails, glamorous hair,
wow,
fabulous fashion, and fun.
Lego is here. Hey, kids, look. A whole new world to build.
New Lego Friends. Welcome to beautiful Heart Lake City. Time to chill with the girls. At the beauty shop, Emma is styled and ready to go. This is going to be so much fun.
We began to see makeup marketed to ever younger girls. Now, you know, there's lingerie for four-year-olds. As preschool girls and their parents are told that they don't want baby dolls and they don't want to look like little girls, they want to look like teenagers, that becomes the norm in the market.
I think that the sexualization of children is not so much about sex, it's really about consuming. That the real point is to turn these children into consumers at a very young age. If you can eroticize shopping in childhood, then you will get these people lined up at the malls for the rest of their lives. What they're doing is they're conditioning girls at incredibly young ages to feel that how they look is what's most important about them, that their lovability depends on their sex appeal, and that they can buy this look and this sex appeal if they just choose the right products and try hard enough.
Boys are not immune to stereotypes and are also heavily targeted by the advertising industry and mass media, but with very different messages.
Here we have the original G.I. Joe from 1964, and I'm afraid that my copy here has lost a couple of his limbs because I have shown him at various conferences around the world. But as you can see, 1964 G.I. Joe, if he were my height or with the size of an average man, would be a perfectly normal-looking man. He has no large biceps or chest muscles or any particular muscularity. But now, let's take a look at G.I. Joe 10 years later from 1975. And as you can see now, G.I. Joe has started to spend a bit of time in the gym. And then, by 1992, we see that G.I. Joe has not only been spending quite a lot of time in the gym, but maybe even has taken a touch of anabolic steroids here and there. So this is sort of a graphic illustration of this evolution of focus on muscularity just over the span of a few decades.
Video games and virtual worlds are impacting both boys and girls. Nowhere is this more evident than in Japan, where the virtual and the real often overlap.
Future bodies. Tokyo. Why are big eyes so popular in Japan? It's because the lead characters in anime and manga always have big eyes. Growing up, Japanese girls and boys see so many of these images, and so they believe that having big eyes equals happiness and success.
The story of AKB-48 is emblematic of what the future may have in store for us. AKB-48 is the most famous music group in Japan, with over 80 members, all girls, ranging in age from 13 to mid-20s. Their concerts, music videos, and product endorsements have made them one of the highest-earning musical acts in the world. Their members are everywhere. They are constantly talked about, their every media appearance carefully dissected by fans. So when a never-before-seen girl starred in a high-profile commercial for the candy company Glico, discussions about her set the media and blogosphere on fire.
When Eguchi Aimi first appeared in her commercial, this was without any type of announcement from the production company. For many fans, there was a moment of disbelief. Was this a new member of this idol group that we had never seen before? Was this a new member who was going to be promoted at the front? Because she was featured prominently in this advertisement in the center.
Eguchi Aimi even appeared on the cover of the Japanese magazine Weekly Playboy, which referred to her as the ultimate love bomb. Fans of the group were in disbelief. Never before had they witnessed such an astronomic rise from obscurity to fame. Something didn't sit right.
And it was only later, and in part through the detective work of the fans themselves, that they came to the conclusion that she was most likely a kind of a digital composite of the various members of the idol group itself. Finally, of course, the production company did reveal that Eguchi Aimi was, in fact, a component of the leading members of this idol group, AKB48. The virtual idol here represents something that is beyond life and death. It becomes an object of timeless beauty and pleasure.
This may very well be one of the first moments in human history when the line between real and virtual has been successfully blurred.
We're going to see real models replaced by these virtual bodies that will be created by computer. So this then will become the image against which real women and girls will be comparing themselves.
If tomorrow women all over the world looked in the mirror, and if they liked what they saw reflected back at them, then we would have to reshape capitalism as we know it. Because how many industries survive on the fact that women are incredibly self-loathing, which of course did not come from nowhere. It came from the media, which is also tied into many of these industries. If you take away that self-loathing that women have, then you will see industries all over the globe go bankrupt. So what I really think young women need to understand is that you are being exploited and you are being manipulated and you are being seduced into hating yourself as a way to generate astronomical profits that keep a very few very wealthy.
Agents of change.
At stake here, in terms of who controls the media, is what kind of society we want to live in. The question becomes, do you want to live in a society that is owned and controlled by a handful of corporations who determine the nature of our visual landscape? Do you want a handful of corporations to determine what femininity should look like, what masculinity should look like, what sexuality should look like? Or do you think that we, as people, should have a right to determine our own cultural images, that we should have a right to decide what kind of culture we live in, and especially what kind of culture our children grow up in? I think that's our basic human right. It is not a right of the corporations.
Ladies and gentlemen, the distinguished author, Mr. Aldous Huxley.
Brave New World is a study of the future as it may be, unless we are extremely careful. It depicts a society in which man has replaced nature by science, morality by drugs, individuality by total conformity. It is a hideous prospect, Yet we seem determined to follow this path of self-destruction. But Brave New World need not be our future. The choice, after all, is always in our own hands.
And our own hands have never been this powerful. Throughout the entire history of mankind, public discourse was tightly controlled by a small caste of wealthy individuals. All this changed in the 1990s with the advent of the Internet. Today, an individual with a device connected to the Internet can spark a revolution. A blogger can be heard as loud and clear as the CEO of a Fortune 500 company.
A 14-year-old is getting credit for inciting change in one of the biggest teen magazines in the industry.
17 magazine promises to get real about beauty after an outcry in May. Julia Bloom, she organized an online petition asking for one unaltered photo spread per month.
Disney is said to be retreating now from its Princess Merida makeover.
Sisters Lexi and Lindsay Kite are on a mission to help girls take back their beauty, and they are countering cosmetic surgery billboards with billboards of their own. They're also speaking across the country, telling girls and their parents to reject all messages that make girls believe their bodies are not good enough.
Across the world, there are almost 3 billion people with an internet connection. 70% of them are online every day. 8 new people start using the internet every second. And there are more than 130,000 new websites created every single day. This has the potential to be an almighty digital army that could be mobilized for change, challenging the status quo, creating healthy media, taking on powerful corporations that profit from our insecurities. I could tell you that we're capable of anything, that we can start a sea change, but it won't be the whole truth. We're in for a fierce, long, challenging battle. The other side has almost endless money and resources at their disposal. It's not going to be easy, but it's definitely going to be worth it.
And the film ends with some text urging you to boycott companies that promote negative body images. Take a break from the mainstream media. Stop obsessing about your looks. And remember the quote from Will Rogers. Advertising is the art of convincing people to spend money they don't have for something they don't need. The Illusionists was written, directed, and produced by Elena Rossini and narrated by Peter Coyote. Find more at illusionists.org and more from us at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimate non-carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Power to the people!
Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up.
Hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
On today's show, you'll hear a speech given by Dr. Robert Bowman in 2006 at a 9/11 Truth Conference. At the time, he was running for Congress as a Democrat. Florida. He was a former director of Advanced Space Programs Development for the U.S. Air Force in the Ford and Carter administrations and a former United States Air Force Lieutenant Colonel with 101 combat missions. He received a Ph.D. in aeronautics and nuclear engineering from the California Institute of Technology. He's also been a very prominent figure in the 9/11 truth movement. He was very vocal about his doubts of 9/11 very early on. And of course, with his background, he knows what he's talking about. Unfortunately, Bob Bowman passed away in August of 2013 after many years battling cancer. I chose to air this speech today because I think it's still very relevant to where we're at today. He connects 9/11 to the broader issues. And I find it an inspiring speech. I feel like it's calling us to action. So here he is, Dr. Robert Bowman, preceded by this brief introduction.
After 22 years in the U.S. Air Force, Lieutenant Colonel Robert Bowman retired in 1978 as Director of Air Force Space Division Advanced Space Programs Development. Until 1982, he was Manager of General Dynamics Advanced Space Programs, Star Wars. Dr. Bowman, Ph.D. Caltech, is the Democratic Party's candidate for Congress in the 15th District in Florida. He was a keynote speaker at the 9/11truth.org MoochCanet-sponsored conference in Chicago, June 2 through 4, 2006. Bowman was introduced by Professor Peter Phillips of Project Censored.
Caltech, Aeronautics, Nuclear Engineering, ran for president in 2000. He's a candidate for Congress in the 15th District in Florida today, and I really welcome Dr. Robert Bowman.
They tell me you don't have to be a rocket scientist to run the government. Nevertheless, I am one. And although I'm running for Congress from the 15th District of Florida against incumbent Republican, which I will not name, when I get there in Washington, I'm going to be your congressman. There's a lot of things that I want to do when I get there. There's several of us running who have agreed that our first piece of legislation that we will co-sponsor will be articles of impeachment. Right up at the top of my list of things to do in Washington is to take the 9/11 truth movement mainstream. It's time this movement moved out of rented hotels and into the halls of Congress. Now, I'm not going to go through a long list of reasons why I think 9/11 is an inside job. If you guys here don't think that by now, too bad. I think that would be carrying coals to Newcastle. I will say, because of my personal experience and personal knowledge as an old interceptor pilot, that I have some idea of what should have gone on that morning of 9/11. I know the drill. I know how long it takes. I've flown those missions. And I don't blame the interceptor pilots that morning. I've looked at the timelines, and I think they did their best under the circumstances. they would have intercepted whatever it was hit those buildings if they had been notified on time. A lot of people say that our government was warned, they knew this was going to happen, and they did nothing. That is not true. If they had done nothing and just let normal procedures take their place, those Twin Towers would still be standing and thousands of dead Americans would still be alive. Now, sometimes when backed into a corner, they try and say, well, it was just incompetence. You know, somebody screwed up. Yeah, they should have notified and scrambled those aircraft as soon as these things went off course, as soon as they lost radio communication, as soon as the IFF transponder failed. Any of those three things should have triggered an immediate call for intercept. Any one of those three things. They all happened, and time went by, and time went by. And those things flew around up there for about an hour and a half. If they had just twiddled their thumbs for 20 minutes and scrambled those jets, they could have intercepted whatever hit the Trade Center before it happened. Now, if this is incompetence, why hasn't anybody been fired, demoted, court-martialed? Now, the people who really had the responsibility, that were in the right place to stop this, have all been promoted or given the Medal of Freedom. This was not incompetence. It was treason. Now, I've been asked to put this in a broader context, relate it to other issues affecting our country. And, of course, that's what I have to do as a candidate for Congress. I have to relate it to all the other issues. And I think it's important that we understand that 9/11 was not an isolated incident in our history. It is related to a lot of other things, and it's related to the situation that we're in right now, and it's related to our very standard of living. Let me give you just some examples here. First, I got to tell you, the United States is number one. Number one in the industrialized world. Number one in our use of the world's resources. Number one in the production of pollution. Number one in the gap between the rich and the poor. Number one in deaths by gunfire. Number one in teen pregnancy. Number one in poverty among the elderly. Number one in citizens without health coverage. Number one in child poverty. Number one in homeless veterans. And number one in citizens behind bars. We're the number one debtor nation in the world. We're number one in the creation of new billionaires, number one in school dropouts, number one in poverty, homelessness, hunger, divorce, suicide, and oh yes, number one in military force, nuclear weapons, and military spending, about as much as the rest of the world combined. This, of course, also makes us number one target of object of fear and hatred in the world, and therefore the number one target of terrorists, along with our allies in Israel. We also lead the world in the number of hours worked per family. Real hourly wages are now about a third of what they were in the 1950s. Ordinary folks in this country don't realize that. They don't understand how we are being stolen from. But think about it. Those of us who grew up in the 1950s supported our families with one job, working 40 hours a week. My kids can't do that. You have to have two wage earners a family. One of them has to have two jobs. And still, they're just trying to squeak by. If ordinary people in this country, working people, got the same percentage of the wealth that they create as we got in the 1950s, people today, because of gains in productivity, we could all support our families with one wage earner, one job, working 2 days a week. We have been conned and lied to about a lot of stuff, and 9/11 is only one of the latest. If worker pay in this country had kept pace with executive pay, the average worker would now be making over $1 million a year, and the minimum wage would be $171 an hour. Now, in its phony war against the terrorists, which its own policies have created, our government has overturned the constitutional protections given us by our founding fathers in the Bill of Rights. In its drive toward a corporate New World Order, it has sold out our workers, our families, our environment, our children's futures, and the American dream, and it has protected their power with 9/11. Now, what went wrong? Why are our workers paid such a tiny percentage of their true worth? What's going on here? The answer is, we have lost our republic. Legislators no longer represent the people who elect them, but the corporations who finance them. They no longer answer to their constituents, but to the lobbyists who line their pockets and fill their campaign coffers. In return, government officials have undone decades of hard-fought victories against the robber barons of the 19th century. For years now, the world's billionaires have directed U.S. policy for their own personal profit. This has included agreements like NAFTA and CAFTA and the World Trade Organization, falsely portrayed as supporting free trade, but in reality promoting free investment, overturning U.S. laws, and putting American workers in competition with those in the third world. That's one reason our wages are so low. It has also resulted in a series of wars from Iraq to Bosnia to Kosovo to Afghanistan to Iraq again, wars which are never in the interest of those fighting them or of the families left behind, wars which only serve the insatiable greed of the global investor class. And when they made their plans for the invasion of Iraq, and they made them in the 1990s, and they published it in black and white, they said in their planning document, the American people will never go for this, unless, to use their words, there's a new Pearl Harbor. And that was 9/11. There is a connection between 9/11 and our economic situation. There's a connection between 9/11 and the fact that the rich keep getting richer and the rest of us keep falling by the wayside. We now have a government which serves the interests of giant agribusiness, giant pharmaceutical companies, giant insurance companies, giant weapons manufacturers, giant oil companies, and all the other global robber barons of the 21st century. Losing out are the rest of us. Increasing numbers of American families in poverty, immigrants working for slave wages, small businesses forced into bankruptcy, seniors unable to afford their medications, disappearing family farmers, what's left of a dwindling middle class, and especially our brave young men and women sent around the world to kill Arabs for the oil companies. Corporate power over our political system, over the media, and over most aspects of our lives is the greatest danger we face today. I said that in those exact words when I ran for president in 2000, And that corporate danger, those renegade billionaires and their hirelings in Washington cemented their power and brought about their plans for imperial conquest by giving us 9/11. Curtailing this power and restoring it to we the people is our greatest challenge. Those of us who dedicate our lives to truth, peace, economic justice, and environmental preservation can make little progress in our struggles so long as ultimate power is in the hands of those who profit from deceit, war, poverty, and pollution. And they are the ones who brought us 9/11 and who attempt to control every aspect of our lives. We must reassert the sovereignty of we the people. And that's why dozens of us non-politicians, and there are several in this room, and I'm among one of about 100 non-politicians, combat veterans all, who are running for Congress. We're Democrats, Republicans, Greens, Libertarians, Independents, but we are united by the fact that we want to take back America, we want to bring home our troops from Bush's quagmire, and we want to expose the lies that it was based on, including 9/11. We want to become a citizens' Congress, serving the needs of the people instead of the greed of the multinational corporations. Now, there are so many specific issues, but I'm just going to mention a few. One is electoral reform. Amen. The immediate need is to outlaw all means of voting which do not result in a paper ballot which can be counted, recounted, and audited as necessary. Without that, everything else is meaningless. But then we also need instant runoff voting, proportional representation, making Election Day a federal holiday, true campaign finance reform, getting rid of burdensome requirements which tend to inhibit the power of third parties and independents, and truly nonpartisan apportionment. Whatever it takes, we must once and for all sever the connection between big money and political power. Now, once that is done, everything else becomes possible. And then, you know, those on the left and right can argue over the specifics of what they want. But we will all be attempting to serve the people. We could have, for example, in this richest of nations, every American can be guaranteed access to a good education, a decent job at a living wage, not a minimum wage, a living wage, health care, including long-term care, prescription drugs, health care, dental care, vision care, hearing care, mental health care, long-term care, through a doctor-run, single-payer national health program. And the undiluted protections of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Artificial fear of terrorism is not going to make this country a police state. Now, we have at times had a bad government. I think this is one of those times. A government with bad policies. But we're a good people. What we have long needed is a government which reflects the values and goodness of the American people. Our values and goodness are not reflected by a government which sends its youth around the world to kill the sons and daughters of working people in other countries. Our values and goodness are not reflected by sending our children to the Middle East to kill Arabs so the oil companies can profit from selling the oil under other people's sand, making us the target of terrorists. We must speak truth to power. And the truth about 9/11 is that we don't know the truth about 9/11. What we do know is that the most unbelievable of all the wild conspiracy theories is the official conspiracy theory told us by our government. We want to get by the bull and know the truth. We have a right to it. Now, the truth about the Iraq war, I think, is much clearer. And it's sort of like this. This war was not caused by faulty intelligence. It was brought on by manipulated intelligence and deliberate deception. This war has nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction or freedom or democracy or human rights or disarming Iraq or defending America or fighting terrorism. It has to do with oil, it has to do with money, and it has to do with raw imperial power. No more Iraqs. No more Kosovos. No more El Salvadors. These are not isolated incidents of stupidity. They're part of a long, bloody history of foreign policy being conducted for the financial interest of the wealthy few. It is a new form of colonialism. It endangers our security. It wastes our youth. It mortgages our future. It brought us 9/11, and it is wrong. Our government should use the men and women in our armed forces to protect our borders and our people, not the financial interests of Folgers, Chiquita Banana, Exxon, and Halliburton. So how do we take the 9/11 truth movement out of rented hotels and into the halls of Congress? Well, that, again, is why we're running. And we are tied together by a promise to uphold and follow the Constitution for a change, to serve people for a change, and to govern on the truth for a change, including the truth of 9/11. When I get to Congress, we are going to demand a truly independent investigation. We are going to demand full disclosure of all the evidence that they haven't already destroyed. And we're going to demand that those who are responsible in our government be removed from office and indicted for treason. When I joined the Air Force, it's a long time ago, I took an oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and that includes a renegade president. We've got to take back America. We must build an America at peace with the world and with its own people. An America that seeks not to be king of the hill, nor subservient to the World Trade Organization, but to be a responsible, sovereign member of the family of nations. an America that is free of the threat of terrorism because it is no longer feared and hated around the world. And because it no longer harbors terrorists in its own halls of power. An America that leads the world, not just with military might, but with its vision, its compassion, its democracy, its freedom, its standard of living, and its treatment of its own people, and its goodness. That's the kind of America our people deserve. And that's the kind of America that I am devoted to build. You know, God bless America. And God grant us regime change in Washington, D.C.
And again, you were just listening to a speech given by Dr. Robert Bowman in June of 2006. And I'm going to end the show today with a song by local artists Carl Seeger Henry and Gary Fox Jr. called Building 7, The Smoking Gun. And here it is.
Building 7, The Smoking Gun. It tells the truth about what was done to me and you and to the world. It tells the truth. It tells it true. 9/11, Building 7. Oh, 9/11, Building 7. At the World Trade Center, three buildings came down, hit by two planes, panic all around. But Building 7 had barely a scratch, not hit by a plane, yet it still collapsed, and office fires were blamed for that. Building 7, The Smoking Gun. It tells the truth about what was done to me and you and to the world. Building 7. Oh, 9/11. Building 7. The first responders saw molten steel. They heard explosions, for they were real. And we all watched a scene surreal. Those buildings fell with roaring blast, a demolition controlled and fast. Building 7, The Smoking Gun. It tells the truth about what was done to me and you and to the world. It tells the truth. It tells the truth. 9/11, Building 7. Oh, 9/11, Building 7. We want the truth. What's the real cause? So many questions, it gives one pause. The official story, so full of flaws. Our leaders command us to just move on. We're here to tell you we won't move on. We're here to tell you we won't move on. We're here to tell you we won't move on. 'Cause Building 7's The Smoking Gun. We see the truth about what was done to me and you and to the world. It tells the truth. It tells the truth. 9/11, Building 7. Oh, 9/11, Building 7.
9/11, Building 7. 9/11, Building 7.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. We are the ones we've been waiting for. Federal workers don't have to be the sacrificial lambs for Trump's political hijinks to fund his wall. And I'm delighted to have on one of our most respected labor leaders in the country, Hector Figueroa, president of Local 32BJ, SEIU, Service Employees International Union. And Hector, I want to start with, because I think this has everything to do with how we got in this position of allowing government to be closed in any event. I was watching, to my horror and dismay, Meet the Press, where Tom Brokaw was a guest. Two of the things that Mr. Brokaw said, which to me informed this whole discussion that we are about to have, he insisted and has for quite some time that the problem with Hispanics are they should work harder at assimilation. That's one of the things I've been saying for a long time. They ought not to be just codified in their communities, but make sure that all their kids are learning to speak English and that they feel comfortable in the communities. But that wasn't enough. A then went on to say, and I just wanted to suggest and talk about that on the Republican side, a lot of people see the rise of an extraordinary important new constituent in American politics, Hispanics, who will, of course, become Democrats. Also, I hear when I push a little harder, well, I don't know whether I want brown grandbabies, Broco added, without elaborating. I mean, that's also a part of it. That, to me, sets the stage. It didn't just begin with him, but somebody with his prominence on Meet the Press. Your thoughts on how this strain of racism in all sectors of the professional community, the political community, and amongst the grassroots informs what happened to our workers with the shutdown of the government over Trump's hijinks to build a wall.
Thank you first for having me on the show, and I couldn't agree more. This is not simply about bickering or a political fight like we used to between Democrats and Republicans, leading to a shutdown over differences on budget priorities. This was a shutdown that was very deliberate, being pursued by the Trump administration over racial politics, xenophobia, and racism displayed by his president and members of his party, with sometimes the consent and collaboration with some folks on the Democratic Party, has been happening for a very long time. The good news in this shutdown is that, contrary to other events, there was a display of incredible unity among Democrats and among unions and among people who could have easily, in the halls of power, taken on the comments by Broco and others and said, let's build the wall. Let's not stop people from working and the federal government for providing services. Let's give the president what he wants and move on. And while you have the people who continue to echo the messaging from this president that we need to be afraid of people who don't look like them, that they need to be supported in the efforts to contain immigrants coming to this country because of who they are. They are mostly people of color coming from different parts of the world who, in their view, change the America that they would like to be, which is a more pale and stale country. The truth is the level of support that they found in this shutdown was not really that much. It was from the fringes of the political spectrum and from people who want to play into those racial politics. I like to put as a contrast the many workers who spoke about the hardship they were going through, many Democrats in Congress who basically said no, not $1, not to the wall, and rejected this kind of politics. So yes, this has been building up for many years. I'm hopeful, cautiously optimistic, that there is a turning point where the tolerance for this kind of trade-off at the expense of the most vulnerable workers in our society is going to start to be increasingly challenged and people not falling for it.
Hector, we're going to play a piece from the Women's March in which one of your members, who is a contract worker, Michelle O'Gara, speaks about her situation being locked out.
Well, and the government's reopened, although we've got this sword of Damocles hanging over our shoulder. And we wanted to play that to remind about the pain that was upon the almost 400,000 workers and forcing another 400,000 deemed essential to show up to work without pay, a large number of employees working for employees with federal contracts who were laid off and no hope of potentially recouping their losses. Just take us back to that moment before we progress and say, what the heck do we have to do to make sure that our working class, our workers are not used as pawns in this game of escalating right reaction and xenophobia in this country?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really happy that you play Michelle. These days in social media, there have been so many conversations as to which protagonist from the working class should get the award for, you know, having the right message at this moment to motivate people and end the shutdown. And I would put Michelle's out there with many others. Faced me as a member of 32BJ who said point blank on CNN, at the risk of losing her job working for a contractor, Mr. Trump give up on the wall. These are workers that are risking a lot. You know, these are not people who can take the level of risk that this involves. You know, their employer could come later and retaliate against them. We're going to make sure that they have the backing of the union if they consider to do so. But these are ordinary workers, not only saying that the hardship of the shutdown is affecting them and they are in need of getting the money for the work that they are still doing but not being paid for, but they're also articulating a vision for this country of unity, of multiracial solidarity, and rejecting the politics of the administration of separating and dividing working people based on who we are, where we come from, and how we look like. I like to go back to that moment because I feel that, again, in the narrative of how we are resisting and fighting, again, culmination of decades of attacks against working people, racism, discrimination, xenophobia, hate of women and people of color. Here you have a woman of color who is very much articulating how many of our members feel, but also a growing segment of the urban multiracial working class, that part of the agent here of change that ended the shutdown. But I'd like to say that we're still fighting for workers like her to be paid. The story that we try to drive very intensely through this shutdown, I think we got the attention of most of the media and people in Congress, and we're going to keep telling it, is that there are two workforces here that were directly impacted. You have the workers directly for the federal government, like the traffic controllers, TSA, and others. And then you have the workers that work for contractors of the federal government, which are actually more lower pay, more diversely represented in terms of the demographics, mostly women and men of color, and then also low paid, lower wages, for whom the loss of income is certain unless we do something about it. The government is not going to pay for the 35 days of this shutdown people like Michelle back wages. So it's now upon us as the union, our allies, members in Congress. Ayanna Pressley introduced a bill in the House. Senator Tony Smith also, I believe, introduced a bill, and we have the support of Nancy Pelosi and Chuck, making sure that these workers will be made whole. But to me, the amazing thing is that even at the risk of the politics not turning in their favor or their employer doing something, they stood up during this shutdown, and they're true heroes. Every time that they spoke against the root cause of the shutdown, and not only their personal story of hardship, but the defiance against the politics of hate. And they are people of color, so they were victimized twice, not being paid and also suffering from the consequences of this administration driving this kind of divisive politics.
Hector, if Trump has the chutzpah and the stupidity to do this again, do we need mass demonstrations across the country, both organized by labor and by progressive groups? Do we really need to come out into the streets?
Absolutely. It took a little bit of time for there to be a response on the streets against the shutdown. And, you know, we can argue and try to figure out why. We have our own view in 32BJ because we were talking to federal unions and impacted unions. And in the past, unions waited to see how it happened. Normally, it would not be for a long duration. Contracted workers, we would not be heard of. So that's why we came so aggressively from day one on the airwaves, telling their stories and making sure they were not invisible anymore. And then as time passed and everybody started to suffer the consequences of no pay in the longest shutdown in our history, then workers began to take more risk, either individually calling sick or, you know, not performing their work, quite frankly, in the way that they're used to, or, you know, talking about and taking action on the streets. We saw demonstrations and rallies in D.C., the takeover of Connell's office by folks, including members of 32BJ, led by workers like Michelle and Faye Smith and others. And then we saw the takeover of the Senate building, the Hart building, for a while. And where we were heading with the actions on the street and in Congress and the workers not showing up to work for free was an escalation. And I think that working people really turn out to be the decisive point of pressure on two ends. One, showing the president with what happened in LaGuardia, Atlanta, DCA, and Newark, where there were not enough traffic controllers, but also with the demonstration to the Democrats that even workers who were at risk were not going to give in to the wall and were not going to give in to the policies of hate, which helped, in my view, keep Democrats more united and not seeking some kind of a compromise to pacify the president. It's important to recognize those two elements here. As we head for the ending of this short extension, there's possibility another shutdown. Trump is talking about it. February 15 is the deadline. We have to mobilize like never in our history in the labor movement, take the greatest level of risk, engage in civil disobedience, do rallies and action, engage in not showing out to work. And then the federal unions need to be very deliberate, but they also have to be careful because, remember, the federal government can easily decertify and end the existence of unions like they did to the traffic controllers. So what that means is that the rest of labor, public sector workers, private sector workers, like the president of the flight attendants made this call on Thursday, we need to do a level of activity and take a level of risk that is much more difficult for people who are in the federal government that Trump wants to privatize and wants to eliminate labor representation. So we need to be strategic. We need to be smart about how we do it. But, yes, we need a big response. And I think that's where we were headed when the shutdown ended.
And we are speaking with Hector Figueroa, president of Local 32BJ, SEIU, Service Employees International Union. And you mentioned the air traffic controllers. And I immediately went back in my mind to PATCO. And I've never let go of my pain that organized labor and community allies did not come out in full force to support their brothers and sisters in PATCO. And Reagan busted that union, the consequences of which are still being felt today in the organized labor movement. And as I say that, I keep thinking about President Trump not only threatened a wage freeze for federal employees, he also proposed cutting their retirement benefits by $143.5 billion. And Congress counter-proposed a 1.9% wage increase. But with the government shutdown, it, of course, is unclear whether federal workers will receive a raise or maintain their pension benefits this year. So the stakes are high, high, and the attacks have been ferocious. And I'm thinking in my mind about France's yellow vests. I'm thinking about a million worker march. I wanted at the Women's March people to say, you're coming back here in another couple of weeks. Get your bus tickets ready. Get your sneakers on, because whether or not the federal workers contractually can do certain things, they certainly have families, community allies, and the private sector unions must see this as a collective battle. What's actually in the work to get that million worker march and say, hell no, not on our watch?
We need to start by making sure that when the president says all workers are going to be getting their back pay and fast, that is actually what happens. So I think that's step number one. Step number two is all the unions are already doing this at the federal level, at the highest level, not only FL-CIO unions, but unions outside of the FL, like SEIU and others, planning what the response is going to be over the next few days. There will be conversations. There will be negotiations. That's the nature of our republic. And we have to make sure that the outcome of that is not something that is a slap in the face of not only the furlough workers, but immigrant workers around the country. So the next step is also to be communicating to Democrats that we cannot have the kind of outcome of this that gives the president what he wanted after workers have suffered so much and resisted what the president was proposing, willing to sacrifice their families. It would be a travesty if we give the president now, within these 3 weeks, what he was seeking to do by holding hostage, you know, American workers and immigrant workers in this country working for American employers. Those are two key pieces. Whether or not the shutdown will lead to the massive mobilization that you're describing, I really don't know. But I do know that in the course of the next 2 years, you're likely going to see an intensification, an escalation that we haven't seen in decades. Look at what precedes Trump and what happens during Trump. Our own union last year organized some 6,000 workers. And we won $19 an hour for airport workers. In the digital media, workers have been organizing a number of venues everywhere. We have seen the success of workers organizing in many points in the country, the defiance of the teachers' union. There has been wave after wave of strikes, with LA being the most recent one, but it also was Chicago, and it was Oklahoma, and it was West Virginia. And then we see the incredible, incredible movement around app workers. The victory of taxi workers in New York City against Uber is extraordinary. It's a David and Goliath story. So I think that we're beginning to see a resurgence of labor militancy, a refocusing on organizing, workers demanding the union, low unemployment, and a direct attack on working people like Janus, and these shutdowns are going to be a very, very dramatic combination to elevate the opportunities for organized labor to rebuild its power and win for people who are in the movement and people who are not in the labor movement. The fight for 15 years is another example. So to me, it's important to envision that million workers' march. Maybe it happens, maybe it doesn't, because, you know, the outcomes are already favorable to us over the next 3 weeks. We don't know. We'll take it day by day. But what I would say is there is already a direction for labor that labor needs to capitalize. We need to invest in motivating working people to take a stand. And whether it's a march or a million different worksite efforts to win dignity and respect for ordinary workers that don't make it into the media, but win the union, win better wages and respect, both are equally important. And they will inform, hopefully, what the candidates for president in 20 intend to do. We need unions for all, and we need to make sure that the root problems of that allowed Trump to exist, the abandonment of the working class by many corporate Democrats, and the racism intrinsic to this country, that we meet both of them, forcefully. And I think that the shutdown allows us to tell a story of potential worker power. Whether it's realized on the streets or not over the next 3 weeks, we won, largely because of the unity of purpose among workers. And we need to continue that story and build from it.
Hector, this is a little bit more difficult question. I'm not going to push you to where necessarily Sarah Nelson, president of the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, went, which is, we need this shutdown to end with a general strike. However, within the organized labor movement, within the federal unions, there are some very conservative leadership who indeed support Trump, support the wall, etc. So how much of an impediment is that going to be, and how much of a struggle is there either between the rank and file and the leadership or other members of organized labor who respond to positions held that are fundamentally xenophobic and conservative and propel Trump forward? I mean, is that something you take on too?
Absolutely. The labor movement is not perfect, and it reflects both the present and the past, but it also, you know, points to the future in ways that are not different from other institutions or organizations in society. And I think that, you know, starting with the call for a general strike, it was interesting because I only learned about the call for the general strike, really, quite frankly, through social media. And we were having our meeting of the ACLU Executive Board, planning and talking about the escalation for the following week, when that call was made, as, if I understand correctly, the head of the flight attendants was receiving an award. And she made that call, and a very powerful and moving speech that I only came to read, quite frankly, over this weekend, because we were very busy trying to figure out how to, you know, fight for 2,000 of members who were desperately seeking food stamps and trying to be able to meet their needs. But that being said, I would say it is very symbolic. The other part that she said was, or something big enough, and she acknowledged that the federal unions were in a more limited way constrained with the question of a strike. So if you read her whole words, it was general strike as a proposition, but underneath it, doing something big, making sure that private sector and public sector unions that are not representing federally employed workers could respond to the fight, and the recognition that there was fear that if federal unions went on strike, that would facilitate a response by the Trump administration of anti-union measures and easily seize the moment to decertify the unions or do much worse. So there is that complexity. And I feel that the movement ahead needs to be recognition that strikes work. We have used strikes to win in union organizing and to win good contracts. Generalized strikes are very, very unique events. Rosa Luxemburg used to be a good teacher about how the mass strike was a unique event that accelerated both class consciousness, political organization, but they are not easily fabricated. They are things that happen under very special circumstances. I think that what we need to do is commit to militancy, commit to organization, have a strategy, and then demand from us more than we normally do during these times, and be willing to take more risks than we would normally accept under the present circumstances. I think that unions are responding in different ways to the Trump administration. There were unions that were trying to get a good deal on infrastructure, looking the other way or swallowing, you know, the racist politics that led to his being in office. That strategy, in my opinion, has failed. There were unions who were out on the streets from day one. We were there, and municipal unions from New York City were there. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how these different tendencies in labor go forward and which tendencies dominate. But I would say whatever it is, I see tremendous opportunity on the 9 out of 10 workers in our economy that have no experience with the union, have no idea what a union is, and are also brewing with discontent, brewing with dissatisfaction in the working conditions, and are horrorized at the growing income inequality and the lack of a voice in the workplace and on the issues that matter most to them. So I think that the more we try to organize those workers, the more the labor movement will change in the direction that we hope will be representative and dominant. The more we focus on the 1 out of 10 and how we resolve our issues and how we defend our members, the weaker we will be. So I think that in this environment, not only do we need to engage in politics and fight contracts and try to sway labor in a more leftward direction, we have to talk to the 9 out of 10 workers and organize them, because they may be the key on how we revitalize the labor movement with a whole new sense of struggle, hope, and militancy.
And Hector Figueroa, president of Local 32BJ, SEIU, just wave at us, and our communities will be there to support our sisters and brothers in the workforce, because we are the ones that we have been waiting for to support our sister and brother federal workers and the working class against a backward reactionary administration. No, dude.
So thank you for having us.
Thank you.
I'm sorry to break over, but I just wanted to say the week of Valentine's Day is February 14th. February 15th, the extension on the budget, you know, comes to an end. A shutdown may happen. Everybody should clear the calendars and have as a day of love the possibility that we'll be taken out on the street on that holiday like never before.
And
if these things don't get resolved.
Fabulous. And we can wear the color red, which for many reasons is my favorite color. So thank you again, Hector Figueroa, President Local 32BJ, SEIU. And, of course, maybe what we do then is also meld that issue, because they really are intimate with the concept of regime change at home and not in Venezuela. No to U.S. orchestrated coup in Venezuela. No to Trump imbuing himself with the power to decide the leader of a sovereign country. Hey, where the heck are the Democrats? This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Way Out.
Research coming out of North America, that's both in the United States and also in Canada, of the Native American people and the First Nations people of Canada, is there are high suicide rates within the LGBTI community. 56% have attempted suicide. So when we use that information based on our shared histories over here in Australia...
Connect the dots. This is what happens.
We can have the mantra that we treat everybody the same, but in reality, in order to treat people equally, we need to treat people differently.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. A Greek Orthodox bishop is convicted of homophobic hate speech. Page turns on Pence after the Smollett hate attack. And Australia's Black Rainbow opens doors for queer Indigenous youth. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Jessica Andrea.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending February 2nd, 2019. In an unusual secular rebuke of a leading religious figure, a Greek Orthodox Church bishop was sentenced on January 28th to 7 months in jail for inciting homophobic hatred and abusing his clerical position. Bishop Ambrosios of Kalavrita was among the most vocal clerics to speak out against a proposed civil unions bill being debated in December 2015 when he called LGBTQ people the dregs of society in a written address published on his blog. Spit on them, he told his followers. Vote against them. They are not human. They are freaks of nature, mentally and spiritually sick. They are mentally insane. Don't hesitate then. Wherever you see them, spit on them. Don't leave them in peace. They are dangerous. Nevertheless, the civil unions bill passed in Parliament on December 22nd of that year. The three-member misdemeanor court in the town of Asio, who found the 79-year-old cleric guilty this week, suspended the sentence. One analyst thought that the court didn't want to further antagonize officials of the politically powerful Greek Orthodox Church. In addition, the bishop would probably be foolhardy to repeat the offense, as judges are likely to see that as him spitting on them. Bishop Ambrosios is the first Greek Orthodox Church official to ever be tried in a secular court, thanks to the complaint brought by nine queer activists who cited Article 196 of the Greek Penal Code, outlawing the abuse of ecclesiastical office.
Activists in the Russian city of St. Petersburg have filed a formal complaint demanding an official investigation into the widely reported detention and abuse of people perceived to be LGBTQ in the country's semi-autonomous, mostly Muslim region of Chechnya. In a statement it submitted to the Investigative Committee of Russia, the country's version of what in the U.S. would be called the FBI, the Russian LGBT network submitted detailed accounts of the detention of 14 people, including torture and at least one murder. The formal complaint is said to be prompted by reports of a renewed purge of queer people in the region that began at the end of December. Chechen dictator Ramzan Kadyrov has consistently denied the charges, and Russian leader Vladimir Putin has said that an investigation that he authorized found no evidence to support the claims. The Russian LGBT network said that more than 40 people have been detained in the latest roundup, including women as well as men perceived to be queer, and that at least two have died during torture. Spokesman Igor Kochetkov, who says he himself has received death threats, told reporters that the 14 cases cited in their complaint accounted for just the people held in one police station in the Chechen capital city, Grozny, and that many more are being held in what amounts to concentration camps elsewhere in the region. The activist group blames Russia's federal authorities for the latest crackdown, saying that their failure to intervene when the purge first began in 2017 has given Chechen strongman Ramzan Kadyrov a sense of impunity. A report by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, issued in December before the current wave of detentions began, charged Russia with failing to live up to its responsibilities. The Russian LGBT network has helped at least 150 LGBTQ people leave Chechnya since the purge began in 2017. It says that about 130 of them managed to go abroad. Rainbow Railroad, a Canadian group, has said it's helped more than 55 Chechens immigrate to their country.
catching up on the latest machinations of Donald Trump and his minions to undermine LGBTQ rights in the United States, the Administration for Children and Families, part of the Department of Health and Human Services, waived anti-bias requirements for federally funded foster care agencies in the state of South Carolina on January 23rd. That allows the faith-based agency called Miracle Hill Ministries to reject prospective non-Christian or non-heterosexual applicants. An Obama-era policy prohibited federally funded organizations from discriminating on the basis of religion. Any other faith-based agencies in the Palmetto State now have the green light to follow suit. Miracle Hill Ministries reportedly places about 15% of South Carolina children with foster parents. The formal request for the waiver was made last year by Republican South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster. The ACLU said on Twitter that children who are waiting for loving and supportive homes deserve better than this.
In another report, this one in foreign policy, the Trump administration lobbied against the selection of former Chilean President Michelle Bachelet to be the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. Though it's not clear if her leftist politics and strong support for marriage equality during her presidential tenure had anything to do with what became a failed U.S. effort to derail her appointment.
Meanwhile, the New York Times has reported on Donald Trump's meeting in the Roosevelt Room of the White House in late January with a group on the far-right fringes of the Republican Party. They were led by Jenny Thomas, the wife of uber-conservative Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Members of the group reportedly railed against marriage equality, the recognition of transgender identity, and even allowing women to serve in the U.S. military during the hour-long meet and greet. Of Jenny Thomas's participation, The Times noted that her activism has raised concerns of conflicts of interest for her husband.
And according to the results of a new Quinnipiac University poll, transgender troops are far more popular with the American public than President Donald Trump. The questions were part of a broader national survey by the well-respected polling group on a variety of political issues, including immigration, the economy, and foreign policy. The U.S. Supreme Court lifted most of the injunctions on implementation of the president's proposed transmilitary ban on January 22nd. 70% in the survey, published on January 29th, believe that qualified transgender people should be allowed to serve in the U.S. Armed Forces. The same survey found that only 38% of the respondents said that Donald Trump is doing a good job.
In other news, Chiba has become the latest city in Japan to issue certificates of recognition to same-gender couples. The municipal government announced its decision to issue the civil partnership certificates in August, and the first were issued on January 29th, with Mayor Toshihito Kumagai presiding over the ceremonies of six same-gender couples. Tokyo's Shibuya and Setagaya wards and the cities of Sapporo, Fukuoka, Osaka, Iga, Takarazuka, and Naha have also issued certificates to same-gender couples, but they've been mostly symbolic. In Chiba, the certificates provide real rights along with the official recognition, including the right to apply as a couple for public housing and mutual hospital visitation when one of them is seriously ill. The couple must be over the age of 20, not currently married, and be residents of the city or planning to move there. Heterosexual couples in Chiba can also become certified civil partners. Japan's conservative federal government continues to resist even legislative debate on some form of legal recognition for same-gender couples.
Kentucky's Republican governor, Matt Bevin, has filed legal papers demanding that former Rowan County clerk Kim Davis pay the $225,000 in legal fees and court costs incurred by the victorious gay couples who sued her after she refused to issue marriage licenses to them. Davis was among a handful of public officials who defied the U.S. Supreme Court's marriage equality ruling. In his 2017 ruling, Judge David Bunning ordered the state of Kentucky to reimburse the couples for the costs of their lawsuit against her. Governor Bevin was a vocal supporter of Davis during her cause celeb jailing and trial, calling her an inspiration to the children of America. But he apparently doesn't want the state to put its money where his mouth was. The governor's legal brief passes the buck to Davis, saying that she had an independent and sworn duty to uphold the law as an elected county officer. Davis lost her bid for re-election in November. A three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, meeting in Cincinnati, Ohio, was scheduled to hear oral arguments in the coming week on who's responsible for the couple's costs.
And finally, about 2,000 people celebrated at the 5th annual Yangon Pride Festival in the biggest city in Myanmar, formerly known as Burma, on the last weekend of January. Homosexuality remains a crime in the socially conservative and predominantly Buddhist Southeast Asian nation under a penal code left by British colonists. A crowd-pleasing drag Olympics topped the festival on January 27th. contestants ran a stiletto race, swirled hula hoops, and competed in a handbag flinging contest. It was only the second year, however, that the Pride celebration was a public event. One of the organizers told Reuters that, when we started this, people did not really dare to come to this kind of festival. The first three gatherings were held in a private facility. Now you see a lot of young people, he said. Young people are more proud and out and encouraged and empowered.
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending February 2nd, 2019. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at the ever-updating thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Jessica Andrea.
There is more overt racism in the gay community, what there is overt homophobia in the Aboriginal community. So that becomes a real struggle for a lot of young people around acceptance.
A suicide prevention group for Australia's queer Indigenous youth adds another colour to the rainbow later in the program. A high-profile hate crime has brought out stars and fans to support its unexpected target. Lucia Chappelle reports.
I was bruised, but my ribs were not cracked. Okay. They were not broken. Okay. I went to the doctor immediately. Frank Gadsden drove me. I was not hospitalized.
Okay.
Both my doctors in LA and Chicago cleared me to perform, but said to take care, obviously. And above all, I fought the back.
Actor-singer Jesse Smollett came back strong on stage at Los Angeles-famed Troubadour on February 2nd after surviving a vicious hate crime attack 4 days earlier in Chicago. The black gay star of Empire had been assaulted by two as-yet-unidentified men near his home in the wee hours of January 29th. Smollett's Make America Great Again shouting attackers hurled racist and homophobic slurs as they beat him, poured an unknown chemical over him, and tied a noose around his neck. Many Hollywood celebrities led the chorus of outrage. Among them was Ellen Page, who spoke out during an appearance on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert and took the blame right to the top.
We have a media that's saying it's a debate whether or not what just happened to Jesse Smollett is a hate crime. It's absurd. This isn't a debate.
I agree.
Sorry, I'm like...
Not at all.
I'm like really fired up tonight,
but... This is how you have to be fired up.
It feels
up.
Impossible to you not feel to, this way right now with yeah. the president and the vice president, Mike Pence, who like wishes I couldn't be married. Let's just be clear. The vice president of America wishes I didn't have the love with my wife. He wanted to ban that in Indiana. He believes in conversion therapy. He has hurt LGBTQ people so badly as the government of Indiana. And I think the thing we need to know, and I hope my show Gaycation did this, in terms of connecting the dots, in terms of what happened the other day to Jesse. I don't know him personally. I send all of my love. Connect the dots. This is what happens. If you are in a position of power and you hate people and you want to cause suffering to them, you go through the trouble. You spend your career trying to cause suffering. What do you think is going to happen? Kids are going to be abused, and they're going to kill themselves. And people are going to be beaten on the street. I have traveled the world, and I have met the most marginalized people you could meet. I am lucky to have this time and the privilege to say this. This needs to stop.
That was lesbian actress Ellen Page. Chicago police and the FBI are pursuing leads in the assault on Smollett and have released surveillance video of two persons of interest in the case. For This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappelle.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis, and you're listening to This Way Out.
White sails in the sun. It wasn't long before they felt the sting.
some wrong line.
To the 2016 Australian census, about 3% of the total population identify as Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander. The British colonization began in 1788, bringing European culture, language, and laws to the continent. The effect was devastating on the First Nations people of Australia. Traditional indigenous societies were broken down as their land was taken from them by colonizers without any formal treaty or other land-sharing arrangements. Limited First Nations land rights settlements have been granted since the 1970s. These days, rates of incarceration and suicide among Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander youth remain disturbingly high. Despite the challenges, Aboriginal communities in Australia remain strong and resilient. Initiatives to reach out to LGBTIQ Indigenous youth have been gaining momentum. The proliferation of interconnected digital technology has made it easier for those living in remote areas to contact support services and to realize they are not alone. Black Rainbow is Australia's first and only national Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander LGBTIQ suicide prevention national advocacy platform and national touchpoint. They support Indigenous LGBTIQ people who are homeless, domestic violence survivors, and those leaving the justice system. Black Rainbow is 100% Indigenous owned and operated. Barry McKay spoke to the founder of Black Rainbow, Damien Bonson, in Canberra at the Canada-Australia Roundtable on Indigenous Health and Wellness in December 2016.
My name's Damien Bonson. My mob are the Manyari people in the Northern Territory, but also from the island of Moorburg in the Torres Strait. I'm the founder of Black Rainbow, a social enterprise in the prevention of Indigenous LGBTI suicide. And this year I was a recipient of the Dr. Yunupingu Award for Human Rights.
In Australia, same-sex attracted and gender-diverse Australians are said to exhibit up to 14 times higher rates of suicide attempts than their heterosexual peers. For Indigenous Australians, deaths by suicide are 1 in 24. International research shows that Indigenous LGBTIQ people are at risk of suicide in the 40 to 45% range. Damien Bonson again.
Looking at the research coming out of North America, that's both in the United States and also in Canada, of the Native American people and the First Nations people of Canada, is there are high suicide rates within the LGBTI community. We're talking about transgender First Nations or Native American people who 56% have attempted suicide. So when we use that information based on our shared histories over here in Australia, we're not really sure who is actually getting through the net here. Recently we had a suicide in Queensland where, in a real unique position, where the young person's sexuality at age 13 was able to be known. So we had an Indigenous teenage boy who was gay who died by suicide. And what that's actually, it's been a catalyst for discussion around, well, what and how are services equipped to respond to the needs of a young teenage Aboriginal gay person or gender diverse person. And that's also that's the both mainstream services, so the Commonwealth services, the everyday services, plus all the Aboriginal services as well. As a young gay Aboriginal person, you can walk into a service and experience homophobia, but it could be culturally validating for you. Or you could go into a service and experience racism, but it could be validating based on your sexuality. So it's looking at how do we grow the capacity of these services to be able to be a front door that young Indigenous LGBTI people can walk through and feel safe about.
So do LGBT youth, Indigenous youth, generally feel accepted by their communities? And if not, why not?
Look, I think so. Not to say that there isn't any sort of homophobia, and which is, I think, is one of the terrible hangovers of colonialism. in Aboriginal communities, when we look at difference, it's more or less defined as, well, that's just how they are, and we include it in the fabric of our communities. Again, it's not the sense of exclusion would come largely through acts of heteronormativity rather than any sort of homophobia discourse that happens. So, again, the work that I try and do is upskill and inform communities around the needs of Indigenous LGBTI people, including us that are older, as well as our young people, so that their services can be seen to be more welcoming. Because once they get through that front door, their services that are in there, they need to access. So it's all about presentation and behaviours around being inclusive.
Do many LGBT Indigenous youth who live out on country in areas which are far away from the large urban centres where there might be more LGBT people to support them, do they generally leave those areas?
Yes, and they often return. I grew up in in one of Australia's smallest capital cities, and I'm 42, so I left about 22 years ago, and it was too small for me, and I went searching for, I guess, the spotlight of the city and even the safety of the city, and it didn't come out until I actually had left my hometown of Darwin. And what we've seen was a lot of young people, and where I particularly live at the moment, which is Broome, is those that do go, they go with a false sense of security to say that this is where I need to be, around other gay people and in that environment. But once they get there, they realise that it's actually it's just another layer of a community of trying to gain acceptance. And there's a lot of racism within the gay community, and I would even say that there is more overt racism in the gay community than what there is overt homophobia in the Aboriginal community. So that becomes a real struggle for a lot of young people around acceptance. Plus, within the gay community, there's an awful lot of subgroups that you've got to navigate and to try and blend into.
Looking back to before the colonial era, were LGBT people accepted within their community? I guess it might be difficult to answer because you've got different nations and communities and language groups around the country. Could you make a comment on that?
I think as the discussion and the more that we have a discussion around the gender diversity and the sexuality diversity of Indigenous peoples, and we had that within our homes and in our communities, we're hearing more and more stories that are coming out. The role and function is still a bit unclear, but again, goes back to that point of difference where that's just how people were. When we look at the sister girls, there was a comment made a couple of years ago that the Tiwi Islands has like three generations of sister girls, which I found quite fascinating in that when transgenderism is a natural occurring event in human life for many people, then what was specific about there being three generations? And taking that a generation is about 25 years, I look back 75 years into this Tiwi Islands and what was happening then, and that's when the missions first set up on the Tiwi Islands. So I hypothesise that as the first time that there was a European gender expression of woman or female that came to the island. So therefore, the Indigenous transgender girls on the island, they saw how this European woman or white woman was presenting herself as female, and they then took on that as well.
I'm Barry Mackay for This Way Out, and I'm in Canberra, Australia, chatting with Damien Bonson, founder of Black Rainbow, Australia's first and only national Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander LGBTIQ suicide prevention national advocacy platform and national touchpoint.
In many Indigenous communities, LGBT people tend to take on the role of maybe healers, medicine men, or a sort of a between the sexes, a sort of a bridge between the sexes. Is there any traditional roles that you know of that LGBT people filled within traditional communities?
Not within in Australia, only what I've read from overseas. I think part of it, again, what's happened in Australia with colonialism was also the destruction of so many stories, and the stories about the roles and functions of those of us that are diverse in gender and sexualities has also gone missing. It's the first time I actually heard that story from the Torres Strait, knowing that the Torres Strait Islands is very heavy on Christianity. Part of my heritage from the Torres Strait Island as well. So I'm looking forward to actually to investigate that a little bit further, because that also plays into the part of our cultural continuity then. So if we can actually share with our young people that there was a pre-existing role and function, it gives them something that extra to hang on to about themselves as they are combating and navigating the world, which has all the ups and downs in it, but also those challenges around their role and function in society as both Aboriginal people and also as people of diverse sexualities and gender. So we can use it as a strength, and it's part of the positive reinforcement of belonging. I think for myself, particularly being at this round table here, where the discussion is a lot around Aboriginal services and non-Aboriginal services and government, one of the things I've been keen to try and draw out from the conversation, particularly in light of the movie that we had last night, Fire Song, which focused on two spirited boys or two Aboriginal gay Canadian young people, is how our Aboriginal services equipping themselves to respond to transgendered people when they're coming through the front door, or gay or lesbian people. We can have the mantra that we treat everybody the same, but in reality, in order to treat people equally, we need to treat people differently, and we have different needs. And they based it's again the little nuances around the heteronormativity, the questions around and this is where I think in the broader discourse of our country is that is around gay marriage as well. This assumption that if you're married and you're gay, then your partner must be of opposite sex. And so, what does your wife do? What does your husband do when you're actually your partner or husband is of the same sex as you? So there's those little things there. But also, again, our communities I feel to be quite welcoming and accepting of difference. It's just an understanding of how to present that back to the community itself and to the community of LGBTI people.
One Australian Aboriginal gay man who has had a successful career as a professional rugby league player and as an international swimwear model is Casey Conway. He has been engaged in youth work with LGBTIQ Aboriginal youth for many years now. I caught up with Casey in Sydney recently.
With your work with LGBTIQ Indigenous youth, what are the main challenges that you face, and what strategies do you use to help build healthy self-esteem with these young people?
Yeah, I think with a lot of our young Indigenous people that are trying to, I guess they're sort of trying to walk in two worlds, trying to be true to themselves and their culture, including their obligations and their need to be a part of their family. Family is something that's really, really important to us, and sometimes, there is a breakdown when they, are coming to terms, with their sexuality or, some of their gender identity issues. So I guess, with me and the work that I do, sort of helping them, build that resilience and independence where they can, confidently, reach out for support, and finding, their place in the world and just letting them know that, there is somebody that has, done it before them and can help them move forward and build that life.
Any personal success stories?
I sort of see everything as success when, when young people, are able to sort of, I guess become more confident in who they are and move forward and, know that it will get better.
You can follow Casey Conway on Twitter at @CaseyConway_. If you'd like to know more about Black Rainbow, head to their website at www.blackrainbow.org.au. This is Barry Mackay in Sydney, Australia for This Way Out.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Jessica Andrea and Wenzel Jones, produced with Ryan DeShazer, from Lucia Chappelle, and from Barry McKay. Goanna performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This layout thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, Paul Bannon, Christopher Matthews, Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, and all of the listener donors who make this program possible. You can join them by visiting thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 5KIX Kangaroo Island, South Australia, WDFM Ossining, New York, KAOS Olympia, Washington, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. What made the Industrial Revolution a revolution? Was it technical innovation? Was it entrepreneurial genius? Was it the flourishing of private enterprises free from state intervention? Or was it something different, something less savory, something rooted in the fact that Britain at the time of the Industrial Revolution was almost constantly at war? In her new book, Priya Sadia argues that the emergence of industrial capitalism was inextricable from war-making, from the mass production of guns with which Britain pursued its wars of imperial conquest. War, she contends, shaped the very invention of industrialism. War, she writes, made the Industrial Revolution. Priya Sadia is professor of history at Stanford University. Her new book is Empire of Guns, The Violent Making of the Industrial Revolution. When Priya joined me in studio, I asked her how a key figure in her book, a Quaker in Britain named Samuel Galton Jr., earned his fortune.
Samuel Galton Jr. was the third generation of a Quaker family in Birmingham that made its fortune through the manufacturing of firearms, but also many other kinds of metal goods, some of them related to firearms and some not.
How big was his gun-making firm, the part that made guns, and to whom or what did it supply arms?
So the Galton firm was the single biggest gun-making firm in Birmingham, perhaps also in England in the 18th century. They were supplying guns to the British government through the Office of Ordnance, but they were also supplying guns to chartered companies like the East India Company and the Hudson's Bay Company, who were, you know, sort of commercial operations, but were also partners of the government. They were chartered by the government, and so we can't really think of them as sort of separate private entities. They also supplied guns to the Irish government, which was, of course, part of the same imperial formation, but had its own sort of contracts for guns. And then there were a range of other private purchasers as well, people involved in the slave trade, you know, the Royal African Company, but also private traders who were trading on their own behalf. And then other kinds of governments as well. For instance, the Portuguese government would buy guns from them. So they had a range of customers, but they were supposed to prioritize the British government when it needed guns during a time of war. And this was a period in which the British government was almost always at war.
Yeah, tell us more. So between 1688 and 1815, how often or how frequently was Britain at war?
Britain was almost always at war. So that period starts, you know, after 1689, you get the start of what's called the 9 Years' War, which lasts for 9 years. And then there's the War of the Spanish Succession just a few years after that. And then there's a bit of a gap before the War of the Austrian Succession, which starts in 1739, 1740. And that ends in 1748. And then a few years later, you have the 7 Years' War, which is known as the French and Indian War in American history textbooks, and that lasts for 7 years. And then there's a few years of gap, and then the American Revolutionary War, which is another long global war. And then finally, from 1793 to 1815, there's this very, very long epic series of wars against France, against revolutionary France, and then Napoleon's France. And so even in those little gaps between the wars, however, it's not that Britain is actually at peace, because it's an expanding empire. So it remains in conflict at the edges of this ever-expanding empire. So, for instance, in that gap in the 1730s, it is still at war with different groups in the West Indies, with Native American nations in North America, with different powers in South Asia that it's trying to subjugate. So it's not like there's a real interlude of peace at any moment in this long 18th century.
So Galton's firm was making guns, among other things. He was a Quaker. How did Quakers feel about war making?
So what most people know about Quakers is that they believe in the unchristian nature of war, and Quakers are not supposed to bear arms. They're not supposed to profit from war in any way. But the really interesting thing here is that the Galton family, so this Galton Jr. and his forefathers, had been involved in gun making from at least 1702. And there doesn't seem to be any record of any kind of objection from the Quaker community for almost the entire century. And then when you get to the 1790s, suddenly you see a lot of objections from Quakers in London, and then finally from Quakers in Birmingham as well, who are saying, you know, as a Quaker, Galton Jr. should not be pursuing this business, and he must give it up. And if he does not give it up, he should be disowned by the Society of Friends.
And part of the reason why they confronted him only in 1795 was because of what guns meant and what guns were used for over the course of the 18th century. So can you share with us sort of the developing image of the gun and the ways in which guns were used or not up till the late 18th century?
Yes, you're exactly right. I mean, one of the key explanations for that timing, for why the Quaker community finds this objectionable in the 1790s and not earlier, is that guns start to look objectionable in a new way in the 1790s. So yes, Quakers are not supposed to bear arms, but it wasn't clear that firearms, in particular, the firearms of that period, were always clearly and exclusively a kind of weapon of war. So many Quakers owned arms in this period. You would need them for agricultural reasons if you're trying to get rid of crows or vermin on your land. So there were those kinds of totally legitimate uses for Quakers and non-Quakers. But primarily, I mean, guns were used by property owners, and they were understood as essential to the protection of property. And this was a period in which property meant civilization itself, and the regime that was established in the Revolution of 1689 was about the right to property and the establishment of a whole kind of national regime based on that notion. And there were no formal police forces in this period. And so what you had instead were property owners owning firearms and using them as a sort of deterrent. people in this period did not use firearms in crimes of passion, in a moment of fury. Rioting crowds and mobs did not use firearms either. And the reason they didn't is because of the way that firearms worked in this period. They were very slow. They were very unwieldy. They were very unreliable. You never quite knew what would happen when you pulled a trigger. And that made them really poor weapons to reach for in a moment of emotion and fury. But they could be quite handy then if you wanted to sort of impersonally threaten a stranger who's trespassing on your property. Now, this is the reality of and the understanding of guns and gun use for most of the 18th century. And that starts to shift in the 1790s. During those long end-of-century wars against France, there's such an unprecedented scale of mass exposure to firearms. So much of the British male population is exposed to firearms. You start to see a kind of shift in the way they are used. And for the first time, you see reports of gun violence that have nothing to do with property and also nothing to do with passion. New kinds of random or casual violence that's quite meaningless and is often perpetrated by ex-soldiers. And suddenly, firearms start to look bad in a new way. And I think that's why the Quaker sect starts to object to Galton's business, particularly in that moment, but also because of the abolition movement that really starts to take off just a few years before this controversy erupts around Galton. And guns figure centrally in the slave trade and become part of the sort of negative publicity about it. The fact that bad guns are dumped in West Africa, or the fact that guns are used on plantations for really sort of wanton forms of violence. And so it's partly the way Galton looks from the standpoint of the Quaker abolition movement and the concern that Quakers have about sort of ethical consistency on a national stage in that moment as they take the lead in this movement. They really are concerned about scandal, and then guns look so particularly scandalous in that moment that finally they raise questions about Galton only in that moment.
And they confront him formally in 1795, as we've been talking about. This is the Quakers, the Society of Friends in Birmingham, England. So how does he respond? What does he do? How does he frame his response to these accusations?
So, you know, he saw himself as a sort of man of the Enlightenment, and he was not sort of cowed by the fingers being raised at him. And what he decided to do was to write a defense of his position as a Quaker gunmaker, and he printed it and circulated it. Because he had that much faith in what he was saying, and he meant it, as he explains in the document itself, it was for posterity, it was for his children and grandchildren, so that they would understand where he was coming from. And I think that's a really important point when we think of the merits of his arguments and how sincerely he meant them or didn't mean them. So he made two main arguments. One was this argument that, you know, yes, guns can sometimes be used as weapons, but they are not always weapons, and that they are part of the spread of civilization. They are like doorknobs and hinges and things that protect property. Okay, so we've talked about that. And we know that until this point, that was kind of a general understanding of guns, but that had begun to shift for many British people by the 1790s. So he was a little late on that. The second big argument he made, though, was that there was little he could do as an economic participant in the West Midlands, in the Birmingham area where he lived, that would not also in some way contribute to war. You know, even if he sat at home and twiddled his thumbs and just paid his taxes, he would be contributing to war. And I think the point he was making was that the emerging industrial economy in particular in the West Midlands owed much to all this continuous war in the 18th century. And he could not have been unaware of the fact that the fellow Quakers who were appointed to kind of reclaim him from this business were people like members of the Lloyd family, the founders of Lloyd's Bank in England today, who were, you know, fellow Quakers. They were relations of the Galton family as well. But they had formerly been the iron suppliers to that gun firm and had founded their bank from the wealth accumulated through providing iron to various kinds of military-related manufacturing. And even as bankers, they were important sources of war financing to the British government. And so from where he sat, Galton is looking at Lloyd and saying, what's the difference between me and you? Maybe it's a difference of degree, but we're arguing about principle here. And so if it's about principle, degree doesn't really matter. And this is really a matter that you have to leave to private conscience to decide.
That's Priya Sadia. She is professor of history at Stanford University, and we are talking about her new book, Empire of Guns, The Violent Making of the Industrial Revolution. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So how would you assess, and part of this book project, I think, is about assessing Galton's defense of himself, and specifically that argument that everybody in this economy, this rapidly transforming economy of Birmingham and environs, was in some way contributing to the state's war-making powers, that they were all somehow complicit in war and in the making of arms. So how would you assess the accuracy of that argument?
So I think when I found that document, when I first started this project, many, many, many years ago, I decided I wanted to test the merits of what Galton was saying. And I thought, and the reason I wanted to do so is that the stakes were very clear and high to me. If he was right that the industrial economy emerging in the West Midlands was emerging thanks to war and government demand related to war, then we have gotten the story of the Industrial Revolution wrong. Because we've told it primarily as a very kind of Pacific story about enterprise and very limited government involvement and the unleashing of invention and knowledge networks. And it's just a very, very peaceful story that has nothing to do with the fact that Britain was almost continuously at war in the very period of the Industrial Revolution. And it seemed to me that if Galton was right, then there was a whole new narrative about the Industrial Revolution to be told that we had missed for a very, very long time. And so it was worth it to me to sort of test the merits of his arguments. And then I went about doing the research to see if he was right about the gun industry in particular. You know, was its transformation in the 18th century due to government demand related to war? And then if it was it anomalous in that sense, or could you make a similar argument about other industries as well? And by the end of, you know, the time I took to write this book, I was persuaded that he was right, that in fact, much of the economic transformation you see in this period in a range of industries, much of that can be traced to war-related demand coming from the state, various different state offices.
Yeah, and if we start with just the guns and the arms, what can you tell us then about the state's involvement in these industries and, I guess, military contracts, government military contracts play a large role. Is that right?
Yes. So if you look at the gun industry, at the beginning of the period we're talking about, British gun makers could make tens of thousands of guns in a year. And those were the needs of war at the time.
This is the late 17th century.
Correct, in the late 17th century. By the early 19th century, by the time of the Napoleonic Wars, British gunmakers could make millions of guns in a year. So that's a pretty revolutionary transformation. And what's interesting is it was not the result of the addition of lots and lots of machinery, which is how we usually think of the Industrial Revolution. There were some new machines, particularly in barrel grinding and welding, but for the most part, it remained a very artisanal process. And so what I saw happening was that when these government offices would put out contracts for guns, and when they would get frustrated with the rate of production not being as quick as they needed, they would go in, officials would go into town in Birmingham and tinker with various different mechanisms available to them to try and speed up production. And they also just expand the number of people involved in production. And then they keep playing with the organization of the industry so that the same artisanal community that could make only tens of thousands at the start of the period was able to make millions by the end. So just to give you a few examples, they play with price incentives. They try to collectivize reception of parts, certain parts that were proving to be bottlenecks in the process, in order to eliminate competition between gun contractors. They created bounty systems to ensure that parts makers would remain dedicated to certain contractors in supplying them rather than sort of allowing other contractors to swoop in and get them on cheaper terms. The government added funds to enable more people to be trained to make the most difficult parts of the guns, namely the gun lock. The government is also doing all kinds of things to support this industry in those interludes of peace by encouraging gun makers and supporting gun makers in their efforts to sell their guns abroad to other customers in the slave trade, in South Asia, in North America, and so on and so forth. They have a really clear understanding of the importance of keeping this industry healthy so that when war inevitably breaks out again in a matter of a few years, gun makers will still be around and able to produce on a very vast scale.
So what you're talking about is massive government intervention. And are you saying then that without that intervention, the Industrial Revolution and kind of commercial and industrial life in 18th century Britain would have been different?
Yes, I do want to say that, especially for this area in the West Midlands. I mean, I think the influence of government contracts and government intervention will vary from region to region, industry to industry. But I do think you can make a case, certainly for the wool industry, for the agricultural industry, for copper industries, iron industries, find the financial world, that much of the development in those areas was stimulated in some fashion by war-related government demand. I think the cotton textile industry, which is where we often focus our attention when we're talking about the British Industrial Revolution, is perhaps, cotton textiles were not really militarily useful, unlike woolen textiles, which were used for soldiers' uniforms. But even the machinery that was developed that made a revolutionary scale of cotton production possible in Britain in this period, a lot of that machinery was being developed by people with ties to Birmingham or from Birmingham who were also involved in designing machines or working on kind of metal industries that were related to the war story. So I think it's hard to quantify, but I do think, generally speaking, yes, this is a big, big missing piece of the story of the Industrial Revolution, that the government had a big role in it and that it did so because it was always engaged in war.
Can you give us other examples of ripple effects that the gun and arms-making industry had on other commercial enterprises?
Yes. So precision instruments, iron manufacturing, clocks, jewelry, the whole range of Birmingham goods called toys, which are any kind of sort of small metal objects like buckles and buttons and things that were produced in Birmingham. Lots of these industries, some of the innovations that would first take place in gun manufacture would then be applied in these other industries as well. And some of the people who were making guns would also be involved in the manufacture of toys and precision instruments and things like that. There was a great deal of overlap. And then this backward linkage to iron production was important as well, because gun makers were very, very fussy and particular about the kind of iron they used. And so you do see gun makers involved in a lot of the experimentation in producing purer and stronger forms of iron and even steel in the Birmingham area in this period.
Another way in which you document kind of the state intervention or meddling or whatever you want to call it in the economy and toward the or in connection with the private sector is based upon a fear that the British government had about concentration within the gun making, armaments making industry. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So there was a revolution in 1689 called the Glorious Revolution that created a constitutional monarchy in Britain. And after that revolution, though, there were concerns about groups within the country who would like to undo that revolution. And those groups were known as Jacobites. And this Jacobite threat was real. There were Jacobite rebellions periodically in the first half of the 18th century. So it's this sort of specter haunting the new regime set up in 1689. And so at the start of this period, the British government could get guns primarily from a chartered company called the Worshipful Company of Gunmakers that was located in the Minories around the Tower of London. They also imported a lot of guns from the Netherlands. Now, the new British government after 1689 is nervous about this because if Jacobites manage to get a hold of those gunmakers or that company of gunmakers, if they manage to bribe them or co-opt them, or if those gunmakers have political sympathy with the Jacobite cause, then what? Then what? And the Dutch source was also not totally reliable because in a time of war, of course, that source could be cut off. So there was this sense that they needed to develop alternate sites of gun production. And so you see, just shortly after the revolution in 1689, this effort by the government to nurture into existence a whole new gun-making industry in this Birmingham region. And so even the very start of that industry owed so much to government. And it was with this political objective in mind of creating rival centers, multiple centers of gun production to avoid the risk of an overly concentrated industry that might more easily be captured by internal enemies in the country.
Priya Sadia joins me in studio. She is an historian based at Stanford University. She's the author of Spies in Arabia, The Great War, and the Cultural Foundations of Britain's Covert Empire in the Middle East. We are talking about her new book. It's called Empire of Guns, The Violent Making of the Industrial Revolution, which uses the gun industry as a window into the relationship between the Industrial Revolution and wars of imperial conquest. Wars, of course, pursued in this case by Britain. So, you know, when we think about state intervention today, we think about the building of infrastructure, the creation of public works, financing education and schools. Did the British state in the period we're talking about, did it see itself as a provider of these kinds of services and, you know, concrete structures?
I think in this period, these were emerging ideas. One thing we have to be careful of is we are used to thinking about state and economy as two clearly distinct things. But what you see happening in the 18th century in Britain is the emergence of clearly distinct state institutions and what you might want to call private economic institutions from what was kind of just a mess of both. So, for instance, people who were contractors were also sometimes salaried employees of the government. It wasn't really clear who was a private individual and who was a state employee and belonging to the realm of state office. And that's something that people start to demand clarity on around the middle of the 18th century because the have-nots in this arrangement get mad about it. And so by the early 19th century, then you do see this effort of sort of making it clear what are state institutions, how are they separate from the economy, and these theories positing, you know, an economy that government does not interfere in, and so on and so forth. So with that in mind, there was not a sort of counterfactual way in which the government could have interfered in or invested in the so-called economy in a more constructive way, say by building schools or canals or infrastructure and all the things that you mentioned. That concept of government just didn't exist yet. But what's interesting is that the government did have a sense of sort of paternalistic obligation towards industry and towards workers generally. And that was partly out of this sense of the political insecurity that could be created if they did not show that concern. So if they weren't concerned about the health of the gun industry, one, then they would not have gun makers at the ready when the next war broke out. And two, there would be a lot of unemployed men around who might then become Jacobites. So it was in the interest of the government to sort of ensure that industry was healthy. So you do see that kind of concern.
Yeah, you're right that in much of the 18th century, the state existed entirely to provide the resources for war. So you have this kind of war-driven industrial revolution, which, as you said, kind of overturns some of maybe our conventional views of what the industrial revolution was and what caused it. How did British government officials feel about people in British colonies acquiring and using the industrial knowledge and innovation being developed in places like the Midlands?
Yes. So Galton, I mentioned, was someone who could see that war contracts were driving industrialism in his area. But he, and that sort of fascinated me, and it seemed like he had a kind of unique perspective. But as I dug deeper, I realized that many people could see that connection. It's only us, later on, we have lost sight of that. And what I found that in there were conversations in Bengal, for instance, where British officials of the East India Company are saying, you know, we're importing an awful lot of military equipment from England. Wouldn't it be cheaper to take advantage of Indian metal working skill and just buy things here? And then the answers that come from other officials are, you know, very clear on this, that, you know, that would be extremely dangerous. First of all, then the mother country, quote unquote, capital M, capital C, the mother country will lose profits, but they don't want to be encouraging the preservation and extension of that kind of metalworking knowledge, especially related to making weapons and war material, because then that could drive an industrial takeoff in the Bengal region, which would also be harmful to the interests of the mother country. So there was a consciousness of that these things are related and that they must certainly not encourage the growth of metalworking skills in Bengal, but they should even work hard to suppress even existing Indian or Bengali knowledge about metalworking, because there were very rich, even gun-making traditions in many parts of South Asia at this point. And you can see over the course of the 18th century how in each place the British co-opt existing manufacturing capacity, suppress it, and also start providing British arms instead to those local Indian powers in order to, again, suppress that indigenous manufacturing capacity and to make those Indian powers more beholden to the British.
That's the voice of Priya Sadia. She is professor of history at Stanford University, and her new book is Empire of Guns, The Violent Making of the Industrial Revolution. It's published by Penguin. We'll take a short break and speak more with Priya about her very interesting book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Priya Satia is my guest, S-A-T-I-A. She teaches history at Stanford University. Her writings have appeared in Slate, The Nation, The Huffington Post, and many other publications. She's the author of Spies in Arabia, and her new book is Empire of Guns, The Violent Making of the Industrial Revolution. Her book reframes the Industrial Revolution, the expansion of British Empire, and the emergence of industrial capitalism by presenting them as inextricable from the gun trade. So what you're saying is, in this period of 1689 to 1815, British society wasn't just an industrial society, it was a military industrial society. which then makes me think of the military-industrial complex, which is a term that I think Dwight Eisenhower formulated, and he was kind of warning U.S. society that this military-industrial complex is gaining power in the U.S. How would you compare that kind of military-industrial society with the military-industrial complex that emerged in the 20th century?
Yes, I do think that they're related. I mean, I think the complex that we live with today emerged from this earlier history of a more diffuse military-industrial society. I think what's different, the reason I'm using the word society rather than complex for the 18th century is because of the emphasis that the British government put on keeping certain industries like the gun industry diffuse. They didn't want a complex. What they were concerned about was that if they just had one or two really favorite, really reliable suppliers, that those suppliers would have way too much power. And then again, if they switched their loyalties to Jacobites, then that would leave the government nowhere. So they were very, very dedicated to the idea of just keeping it diffuse, which makes it something different from the complex that we are familiar with today. That said, I do think there's a moment in the second half of the 19th century where you can sort of see this military-industrial society changing and becoming something more recognizably complex-like. And I think that has to do with the concentration of industry, the corporatization of industry that happens in the second half of the 19th century. That's when you have the emergence, for instance, of BSA, the Birmingham Small Arms Factory, which becomes the single largest rifle maker in Europe by the end of the 19th century. And you see in the early 20th century, the British government just only relies on one or two British suppliers for most of its needs, but it can also starts to source many arms abroad as well. And so you see this kind of concentration and shrinking of it's not a shrinking in the numbers of people participating, but in the number of contractors or big corporations that the British government partners with. And so that is distinct from the 18th century, when you do just see a much more diffuse level of participation with lots of people making small profit working for and with the government, as opposed to the 20th century when we're talking about a few companies making lots of profits. And it's a different kind of, you know, scale of corruption, if you want to call it that, by the 20th century.
So if we go back to 1795, again, the Society of Friends in Birmingham, they confront Samuel Galton Jr., this owner of this large gun-making firm in Birmingham, and they say, we are going to disown you unless you stop this business because it's immoral. And you've told us about the arguments that he presented to them, and he actually, as you said, published this document. So how did they respond to his defense of what he was doing, and maybe specifically this idea that, you know, we're all complicit in it, so, you know, why are you accusing me in particular?
Yeah, so it's interesting. The Religious Society of Friends didn't buy his argument. And within a few months after he publishes this defense, the disownment process unfolds. And formally, he's disowned. But it doesn't affect him. He continues to go to the local meeting and attend the worship. He continues to make donations to Quaker charitable causes, and his donations are accepted. And this, it's important to note, this is at a moment during the Napoleonic Wars when his gun-making enterprise really starts to make enormous profits on a whole new scale. And yet he remains part of this Quaker community and ignores the disownment, basically. And I think that says something about his standing in the local Quaker community, that perhaps if his arguments were not accepted formally, there must have been enough people in the Birmingham group who sympathized or kind of got what he meant and who knew they were complicit as well, like the Lloyds, and so sort of tolerated him, his continued presence among them. That said, then the Samuel Galton Jr. does shortly into the 19th century, pass on ownership of the firm to his son, who's called Samuel Tertius Galton. And they also start a bank. And so there's about a decade when Samuel Tertius Galton is both the head of this Galton Bank and the head of the gun-making firm. And he marries outside the Quaker fold. And so he sort of falls out of Quaker ranks for that reason. But then after 1815, when the wars end, the Galton gun-making business is wound up and they are only bankers after that point. And their bank becomes, you know, one of the components of what became Midland Bank, which in the 1990s, I want to say, was folded into HSBC, which is still with us today.
When the Quakers refused to accept Samuel Galton Jr.'s arguments, what that says to me is that there was a kind of denial of moral responsibility among the Quaker community, right? That they didn't see themselves as being morally culpable in relation to what was going on with militarism and gun making and arms making and the interrelationship of all these industries and finance with war making. What does that tell you, this sort of refusal to accept moral responsibility for something that I guess if you looked at maybe more objectively, you would say, yeah, they're complicit?
So I think what you see is this logic operating, right, where by pointing their finger at Galton as sort of a particularly morally culpable figure because he's a gunmaker, the Quaker society then feels comfortable generally, you know, in its conscience that the rest of the community is above reproach in some sense. So they've identified the scandalous figure in their midst. And I think this is a kind of process of cleansing, moral cleansing or purification that I think echoes down the line in the history of capitalism generally. You see it happening here in the Quaker community, but I think this is something we habitually do. We say drug trafficking is bad, or the slave trade is bad, or arms trading is bad. But otherwise, the rest of trade and capitalism is all right. And I think what this story about Galton in the era of the Industrial Revolution shows us is that so many people are complicit in these things, almost de facto and, ineluctably in the trade or in the manufacture and trade of things like drugs or guns or the procurement of slaves, that there is a sort of faulty logic in trying to focus our energies on eliminating those sort of bad goods and thinking that the rest of it can continue to operate intact. And I do think that right now we're sort of confronting this with the gun control movement in the United States, where there's this effort to boycott businesses and industries that are implicated in the manufacture and sale of things like AR-15s. And we're finding that you have to cast a very, very wide net to actually boycott the various different kinds of businesses that are involved, because lots and lots of kinds of businesses and industries are complicit, from banks to advertising firms to retailers to law firms. I mean, it's very, very, we're discovering just how wide that net of complicity is. And I think this is something that's been true from the beginning, and that these bad goods are actually a product of the whole system of industrial capitalism, not just a few bad guys who commit to making or selling those things.
In other words, a structural critique is needed, maybe in place of simply focusing on a presumably isolated sector of the economy or a bad commodity.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Priya Satya joins me. She is professor of history at Stanford University. Her new book is Empire of Guns: The Violent Making of the Industrial Revolution. So you spoke earlier about the conventional argument that the Industrial Revolution was driven by free enterprise with a minimum of government interference. How influential has that argument been on discussions of what drives innovation and economic growth and what role governments should play in the economy?
I think that idea has been extremely influential, and it's sort of been the source of our default understanding that if you want economic progress, especially since the 1990s, if you want economic progress in any country, the government needs to stop interfering. And, you know, you can think of many different cases where that logic has been applied. And I think if you look at Britain in particular, there has been this sense, for instance, with the rise of the welfare state after World War II, that that was really revolutionary, that here you have a country in which traditionally the government has refrained from interfering in the economy. That's why there was an industrial revolution. And now suddenly, in a new way, the government is interfering in the economy, has a huge presence in the economy. And people who see the narrative that way in the last couple of decades have worked really hard to dismantle that post-World War II welfare state so that Britain can return to a more kind of authentically British version of itself in which the government has a very small role in the economy. So if we now find that, in fact, traditionally, or at least from the beginning of the history of modern state institutions in Britain, the British government has had a very big role in the economic transformations that country saw, then this post-World War II welfare state does not look like such a dramatic break with the past, where before you had a warfare state, now you have a welfare state. But all along, for most of the modern period, that means the British state has had a presence, a very kind of foundational presence in the British economy, and has really shaped the dimensions of its evolution in the modern period. So there's a lot at stake in revising our understanding of the Industrial Revolution. And just if you look at the developing world today and the arguments people come up with against government interference, or the conditions that are put, you know, on loans that are given to such governments that, you know, you have to follow certain neoliberal conditions. I mean, all of this can be traced in some sense to the idea that the first instance of industrial takeoff in the world, which happened in Britain, was all about a situation in which government knew its place and didn't interfere. So once you change that story, you upset a lot of conventional wisdom about what the government's role should be in innovation and in development. If you look at Silicon Valley itself, I mean, we also have a mythology about that as sort of the flourishing of genius and innovation and invention and free enterprise. But if memory serves you correctly, you know, it should remind you that Silicon Valley grew up thanks to Cold War defense contracts. And even today, a lot of the biggest names in Silicon Valley, companies like Google, they do get very important defense contracts. And sometimes those are controversial, as they should be.
So 18th century Britain, the Industrial Revolution, a state of almost constant war, war making being kind of an obsession of the successive governments in Britain, and of course the industries that supplied the war making effort. I guess my question is, like, do you think 18th century British, the 18th century British state would have industrialized if it had not been constantly at war? I mean, how important was war to the whole driving of the, and in fact, maybe even the existence of the Industrial Revolution?
I do think you would have seen industrialism in Britain, but I don't think it would have been a revolutionary event. I think that scale of transformation owed a lot to war. I think in so many places in the world, you see increasing industrial activity. Right, on the continent, in South Asia, in parts of the Middle East, so it's not something, industrialism is not something unique to Britain, but the Industrial Revolution, that scale of change in Britain, I think does have something to do with war, with the fact that Britain was always at war. And I think that because it comes out of these wars of colonial conquest, in which there was this conscious effort to also decrease or smother industrialism in other places, that also helped the scale of change become more revolutionary within Britain. If there hadn't been those wars of colonial conquest, there would have been industrialism in Britain, but there would also have been industrialism in Bengal and in Awadh and in other places around the world that Britain was behaving belligerently in. Even in North America and the American colonies, I mean, they developed the way they did because of British colonialism. So it's sort of a weird counterfactual. But you know, the efforts to ignite industrial activity there were very actively suppressed by British industrialists at home because they were always concerned about the mother country. And this is what colonists in the Americas were rebelling against. This was one of the thorns in their side that they wanted to get rid of when it came to the 1760s, 1770s. So yeah, I think it would have been a much more even process globally, and less revolutionary within Britain itself.
You point in this book to a lot of thinkers, maybe the majority of thinkers, who wanted to or would or have kind of denied the role of war making in the Industrial Revolution, who have said that arms making, if anything, had kind of a negative effect, a negative impact on the economy, or was maybe kind of an ancillary part of the economic activity that constituted this extraordinary transformation in commercial and industrial life. Why do you think thinkers would do that? Why discount or ignore the role of war in the Industrial Revolution?
So I think there are three reasons for that. One is just the enormous influence of liberal political economic theory. So even though I'm finding now that war was a big factor in industrial transformation in Britain in this period, Adam Smith was writing at the same time and inventing theories of economic growth in which the government and war had the most, the negligible role possible. And I think that theory has in some ways displaced reality. So that's one reason. The second reason is that a lot of our scholarship on the Industrial Revolution started to come out, a lot of the sort of seminal work on it started to come out in the 1920s and 1930s and 1940s, in the period of the World Wars. And in that period, the thinkers who were making arguments about war driving economic growth were often sympathetic to Nazi thought, like people like Werner Sombart, the sociologist. And I think the stakes for saying that, no, there's a really important foundational case of economic growth in which war did not have a role, the stakes for saying that and believing that were very, very high. People didn't want to have, didn't know, it's such an unseemly idea, and it's very hard to live with. But I think what's happened is that it's sort of left us in a kind of denial about the reality of war's role in the Industrial Revolution. So, and the third reason is that I think there's a sense of, what's the word I want to use? I mean, there's, broadly speaking, even today in the British education system and in popular culture, a continuing sort of denial about the negative effects, the negative impact of British imperialism. And I do think that's something to contend with on a broader scale. And I think painting the Industrial Revolution as this Pacific affair that didn't have anything to do with imperialism, that's not tainted by imperialism, I think that is important to the kind of British myth about itself. So I think that's a third reason why there is this continued avoidance of that possibility that wars of colonial conquest may have driven industrial transformation in Britain.
Yeah, right. This notion, as you're right, of the British Empire as a peaceable and mm-hmm. liberal empire, I mean, that would be subverted by, an emphasis on war's role in British economic growth.
Yes, there's this weird arrangement of scholarship on the 18th century where there's lots of books on the military history of the period, and then there's lots of books on the economic history, and you would read each one and not imagine that the other one existed. there's sort of parallel histories. And there's this sense that, yes, if there was a British Empire, it was a very Pacific entity. It brought civilization. It had a navy, maybe, but it was not this sort of violent, aggressive power. And that is a myth.
Priya Sadia, historian based at Stanford University. You can check out her book, Spies in Arabia, The Great War and the Cultural Foundations of Britain's Covert Empire in the Middle East. We've been talking about her new book published by Penguin. It's called Empire of Guns, The Violent Making of the Industrial Revolution. Very interesting, intriguing book, Priya. Thanks so much for joining us to talk about it.
Thank you so much for having me, C.S.
And that interview first aired last August 8th.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.